Welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 60, Misguided. I am May, and I am here with
Tatiana
and Jessica.
And we recap DC TV in a flash. You can contact us by email at ladieswgumption@gmail.com, on Twitter at DCTVGumption, on Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, and you can listen to our podcast on Podomatic, iTunes, and Google Play. This week, we have lots of feedback, beginning with KJ over on Twitter, who we have not forgotten.
Whom we
KJ.
Love greatly.
We have not forgotten you, I promise. And he basically was saying, regarding the crossover, that if the Legends cameo isn't Brandon Routh bumping into Tyler Hoechlin, then what's even the point? And I agree, because I think they made a joke about it was with him, and he was saying that Supergirl looked like his cousin. This would be a missed opportunity to not have him, you know, meet Tyler as Superman. We had Shang over on Tumblr who sent us an ask, a two-part ask. He thought Supergirl was a horrible episode. He was really angry about it. He thinks the plot of Children of Liberty is horrendous, and about marking the doors because it reminded him of Nazis. And instead of them realizing they are marking aliens, we get more time spent on CGI dragons, which is not a priority.
Aww.
Yeah. And he's kind of pissed about the whole James storyline. And
yeah.
He does like Manchester Black, so that's a great point. Doesn't like that his man pain is the backstory, but at least, like, he's doing something, basically. So thank you, Shang, for your feedback. We had another Anon on, or we had an Anon on Tumblr with a three-part ask. The Anon thinks that the last episode of The Flash was terrible, and it was definitely one of the worst episodes of the show. Caitlin's storyline is boring and inconsistent, and Anon is not here for another Killer Frost wreck. Is tired of the storyline, that they should just make her evil and be done with it. Loved the parts of Nora and Iris interacting, and thinks that Candace and Jessica Parker Kennedy have great chemistry together. So it's great to see that we finally have a positive mother and daughter relationship on the show, and thinks that the reviews pretty much dragged the episode and was so, like, the reviewers match the fandom's feelings on the episode in general. Over in our emails, which I will look up, Tasha is back this week. Hello, Tasha. Welcome back. For Arrow's sixth episode, she said this episode was a lot, and she liked Felicity and Atoli in general, and that she did give Felicity some side eye when she lied about Anatoly being threatened when he went in to get the USB, but generally liked that she apologized and gave Anatoly papers to start a new life. With regards to Felicity and Diggle, she says that he shot his own brother to protect his family, but thinks it's hypocritical that he's judging Felicity for going to extremes to protect hers. Felicity's siren, she's continues to be entertained by their interactions, and she has a couple of new predictions regarding Star City 2040.
It could be right again.
Yes, she thinks that we're going to find out about that. We're going to find out that Felicity is undercover with someone else's evil plan to destroy what's left of Star City, and that's why she disappeared. And she thinks Kat McNamara's character, Maya, is going to be a part of the flash-forward storyline, and will meet her when the team uses the map of the tunnels Felicity left to go into the glades. For Slash...
I'll save that for my predictions.
Okay. She doesn't know... Oh, she's not sure that we know who Hood 2.0 is yet, so she won't spoil us. Interesting. Okay. But she thinks that when Talia comes back, that she'll be connected to whoever is under the mask. Interesting. And for...
That's a very interesting suggestion.
So Tasha knows who is under the hood.
I want to know. Like, spoil me, Tasha.
Tell us an email. We won't tell anyone.
Won't tell, promise.
Yeah. For Titans 1-6, she has some Titans thoughts this week. Corey continues to be the best thing about the show. Her and Raven are the only things that make Dick's brooding bearable, and Gar is adorable, and can Jason go away, not come back? Our next email is from Addie, who had some Flash thoughts, lots of feelings about the Flash, and she, or he, can't be invested in another Killer Frost origin episode. It's not consistent, and it changes to fit the plot, and still very annoyed at the fact that Caitlin is never held accountable for her actions, while the other characters both on the show and the fandom are. Caitlin did and said some awful things because she did not want these powers in season 3 and 4, so it makes no sense to me why she would be so hung up on a murderous alter ego she so desperately wanted to get rid of. And the things Addie liked were the Nora and Iris bonding, which made them so happy, and then the little handshake, and then Barry calling Iris to check on his girls, which was sweet. So thank you, Addie, for your email. Moving on to Lisa, who's our final feedback of this week. She wishes us a happy post-Thanksgiving, and she tried, but she can't anymore, and she's so tired of Killer Frost. She realizes it's probably a bigger undertaking since Robbie and Mel left the CW because they like romance, so it's really hard to get invested in this storyline because this season has been beyond expectation, but after this episode, it just showed that this episode wasn't good in comparison to like the rest of the season. Again,
for sure.
Caitlin didn't want these powers in season 3, the ones that she blamed Barry's time travel for and she desperately wanted to get rid of, and then she attacked Julian, Barry, Cisco, and Cecilia trying to get to Savitar and then tried to kill Iris. So it dredged up the fact that she never apologized to anyone except for Joe for her mess and made her realize neither her nor Barry are worthy of Cisco's friendship.
Womp.
Yeah. And basically the consensus is that the Iris-Nora team-up was really good. So thank you everybody for the feedback. That was only like the highlights of the feedback, so the rest of them will be posted to Tumblr and you can respond and reblog and interact with everyone on our Tumblr. And moving on to news, last Saturday was the Flash 100 party, so all cast, crew, producers, press were all up in Vancouver to celebrate the Flash celebrating 100 episodes. A couple of interviews have started to come out, but I'm sure we'll get like tons more during the week of the actual episode airing. Birds of Prey got a movie title. It is officially now Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, which is a long title and no one knows why.
And emancipation is such a weird word to use.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Like, I understand what they're saying, but it's like being set free from like your parents. So I don't know.
Kind of. I think they're trying to separate them. Her from a bird of prey, but then I'm not sure why like they're separating her in the title as well.
Well, yeah, like a bird of prey. Like I think, you know, I don't know. I feel like people would be more annoyed if they tried to like it's her movie, and they also put her in the Birds of Prey, and it's like just Harley-fying everything in the DC. So I'm like it's a long title, but it's very Harley that she would just like you know, Annie. Also on like a storyline, and I guess like emancipation from the Joker is I guess
right. No, exactly. That's what they're going for. Yeah. No, I mean I think that like yes, if they just called it Birds of Prey and Harley was in it and it was clear she wasn't part of the Birds of Prey, then that's that. I agree that it's cute, like and the fabulous emancipation of Harley Quinn. But if they're actually trying to put that in the title when they're like talking about the movie, that's gonna make it really hard. They should just call it Birds of Prey.
Yeah.
You know, you can have that as a subtitle. Well, let's not include that in our discussions of the film, or like, you know, when you're writing out the film title.
It's like a mouthful when you're trying to like do an interview. So about your movie, Birds of Prey.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think people were already calling it Birds of Prey and that's what they'll continue to do. I'm not sure what the hashtag will look like now. Alright, so that's all the news we had for this week. As usual, our format is side A and side B. We'll recap the shows, discuss what we liked and didn't like, and of course crown this week's Lady with Gumption of the Week. For side A, titled Playing God / Half Measure / Project Hades, Jessica will take it away as our host.
Yes, and before I take it away, I do want to put in here like a little PSA. I don't think that we have, like, just knowing what our demographics seem to be, I don't know that we have any kind of Caitlin fans, but if you are like any kind of way, even like platonically lukewarm kind of feeling about Caitlin Snow, just skip the Flash part and come back next week. I put this out like when we had the crossover last season and we were like, just PSA, if you like Oliver, Felicity, just skip this and we'll go back to being like more friendly next week. Just like that's the same thing. Like just skip this episode. The Flash portion. If you watch other shows it's fine, but just skip the Flash and we'll be more nonpartisan next week. So, That is your public service announcement for that. So getting into side A, starting with Supergirl, the recap, or the summary for this episode is, it's Thanksgiving, so everyone gathers for Thanksgiving, but Kara is feeling down after her televised debate with Ben Lockwood about the anti-alien sentiment coursing through National City. Goes off the road. Like, it doesn't end as well or on a positive note like she thought it would. So she's feeling kind of down. They have the worst Thanksgiving debate ever about alien sentiment and the Children of Liberty. And that is because James and Leah are arguing about the best way to handle the Children of Liberty. And it is also the worst argument ever. So, other things we learned in this episode, Nia, we get a little bit more insight to her quote-unquote narcolepsy. And Brandy likes sweet potato pie. This episode was directed by Antonio Negrete and written by Gabriel Yanis and Daniel Beattie. So, what did we like about this episode? Who wants to start?
Be my guest, May.
All right. Gotta get ready. Well, my first thought has to go to the Harry Potter references, of course, especially coming from Alex because it was unexpected and it played well comedically. And I continue to love Brainy and Nia's interactions. They're so awkward and sweet, and I'm ready for the ship to rise. I love Brainy not understanding Alex's wink at first and then later coming up with a plan of distracting Haley. I think he's getting nice little moments for developing his social skills and bettering his interactions with his human friends. And then him beating up those guys using science was truly iconic. He's like, I will use physics, and then just goes into all of this little cool stuff. It was really cute. And I like that they're slowly building up towards Nia's powers, like the reveal of her powers. And I like that they're doing it in this way so that we're getting like a little bit every episode. And now we're getting much more, or we're starting to get much more. And I really was kind of rooting for Manchester Black this episode because he's like the only one who's actually doing something useful to try and get to Agent Liberty while everyone else was trying to play nice. His plot is currently the only one that makes sense, and that's kind of weird. And I also like that Alex did stand her ground against Colonel Haley when it came to the mission. Like, she thought it was important to try and protect people from the Children of Liberty, and to see them as a threat. And then her final speech to Haley was a really good moment for her. And finally, I like that Kara was nervous before going on the show to battle it out with Lockwood, and that it was Nia who gave her the mentor-style pep talk. And I think she did a decent job coming to the defense of aliens, given that it was last minute and she had zero prep time, so I think she handled herself fairly
well. Starting from that, I totally agree that Kara handled herself well, considering that Ben's shitty rebuttal was in overtime. And it also relied on him once again bringing up the slaughter of Native Americans as if that would somehow explain why he should get to slaughter other people before they could slaughter him. So, good job, Kara, for having a superior argument. Plus, if James had been there, he would have sucked. Anyway, yeah. I was full-on cheering for Manchester at the start of the episode. I mean, obviously kidnapping and torture and then shooting people at the end is not a good thing, but no one else is doing anything to stop the madness, so 4 for you, Manchester. You gotta do what you gotta do. Also, I love that he apologized to Fiona before he shot their asses. Because I was like, where is the promise you made, Fiona? And then he was like, sorry, Fiona. Gotta go. Okay. I also love John inviting Mitch to Thanksgiving dinner, and then him actually popping by for a second. Like, I thought they had a really nice conversation. I would like it to be a real friendship before John finds out that he's capping people. So, then they'll obviously fall apart. But for a little bit, it'll be nice. Brainy's communication snafus and attempts at understanding subterfuge were very adorable. I really liked him, Kara, and Alex, like, working together to, like, bypass Colonel Haley. So that's great. I also really super ship Brainy and Nia every time they interact. Easy my feelings. I want to see the ship. And speaking of Nia, I really liked that we saw the hints of her power, and I liked how supportive she was of Kara when she gave her that nice little pep talk. Now, as for the James and Lena stuff, the only part of that I liked was her pulling the boss card on him when she was like, oh, this is work. Like, you don't want to talk to your girlfriend about this job. So how about you talk to your boss about how you have to go to this? It didn't work, unfortunately. But I liked it because it reminded me of when she did it to Kara, who was slacking off while being a reporter, supposedly. So good work, Lena. Draw on those lines. Finally, the pet dragon was very cute. I love that the little girl's presence was what calmed Spike down. And then, you know, love wins in the end. Family first. That's all.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that in, like, the recap part, but Kara did fight a dragon. It was a Komodo dragon, but he did transform into a real dragon when he needed to protect his family. So go, Spike, go. I thought it was cute how she, once he calmed down, she's like, Spike, it's okay. Your family is safe. Good boy, Spike. And then he's like, okay. And she's like, aw, you're sweet now. So I thought that was really cute. I know he's supposed to, like, I assume, become a villain later on, but I can't find a reason not to like Manchester Black right now. Like, when we were talking before the season started about, you know, his character coming in, and there's already, like, background pictures, BTS pictures of him and Kara teaming up, and you're like, oh, he could be a good guy, but then you, like, look at his background, it's like, no, he's really not. So, I feel like they'll eventually swing him around to we're supposed to think he's a villain, but, like, he's the only bitch in this house I respect at the moment. He's the only one kind of doing, well, one of the only ones doing things. Actually actively going out and patrolling the streets, tracking aliens, minding their own business from, like, the Ku Klux Klan, basically. Like, am I supposed to feel bad that he kept one locked in his bathroom to interrogate for information? Because I don't. Like, I, you know, what do you want me to say about this police officer that was obviously racist and targeted his fiance being, you know, hung up in a bathroom? Like, you know, I'm just like Kanye shrug, because I don't have any sympathy for you, really. I like that Manchester is his own one-man army. Like, yes, he's motivated by revenge, but at least he's, like, doing something. He's taking a stand. My other shining stars in this episode, I think Brie outsold as usual. We got one and on asking this week if we thought there was, like, too much Brainy. And I feel like he certainly does get, like, a lot of screen time. But honestly, like, the show needs his personality and needs those little charismatic, cute, fish-out-of-water moments to break up all, like, the racism and hate speech that is the other 30 minutes of the episode. So I like that he's there to kind of lighten up Supergirl. He has great taste and he enjoys sweet potato pie. Which, by the way, so Daniel Beattie is the black man in the Supergirl writer's room. And I was like, thank God. Like, this is diversity in the details. Because if it was anybody else, I'm pretty sure, like, Colonel Haley would have made pumpkin pie. Black people on Thanksgiving make sweet potato pie. Like, that's the black thing. So I like that she made sweet potato pie. And that's just, like, a little kind of, not nitpick, but little detail that I'm pretty sure is in there because Daniel's black and he knows what's up. So, yay for diversity. Brainy, it's because it's kind of like, you know, like on The Flash when for five seasons, Joe West is talking about noodle dishes and all this kind of stuff. Like, noodle dishes? Like, black people don't make noodle dishes. So, having that on, like, Supergirl, I thought was good. Anyway, Brainy and Nia interacting, they're super cute. I love that Brainy actually, like, came with flowers for Kara since he was a guest, even if they were fake flowers. Like, he was, you know, like, Nia's whole thing, like, your mother raised you right. And he's like, no, she did not. but I like that he brought something as a guest. And then, of course, Alex, Kara, and Brainy teaming up to kind of work around Haley not letting them investigate worked well. I like that he brought the Children of Liberty mask to dinner because he thought that it was going to be boring. and like you said, man, like his fighting style, like, matched his personality. Like, when he's like, I'm going to beat you up with physics, which is like an A-plus line, by the way. Like, they did try to make him, you know, work with strength or whatever. He uses his skill set to his advantage and looks really cool, and I like that a lot. And then I like how Mia's sleep disorder came up more explicitly and how she's trying to right now explain it away as narcolepsy, because that's a very believable excuse. So, but we know that soon Dreamer will rise. Soon, I'm ready. And then lastly, my last shining star goes to Kara for holding her own against Ben Lockwood on short notice after James flaked out. Ben got the last word, but she did her best and she held her ground, and I thought it was really good to see her, you know. She's also the one that's, like, taking that stand and standing up for aliens, alien community, and that's kind of, like, that's the Supergirl that you want to see. Things that we did not like about this episode.
I mean, most of this episode was a shit show, to be honest. It's like the writers forgot how to have the characters drive the plot instead of the other way around. So, like, James, no matter what he tried to do this episode, or no matter how well-intentioned it was in his eyes, it was just plain dumb and stupid, no matter how many ways you look at it. So he was trying to see the other side and sympathize with the Children of Liberty instead of doing the right thing and take a stand. It especially looks hypocritical because he wrote a whole article saying Catco won't stand for hatred, and yet he goes against everything he wrote with his actions in this episode. So he was stubborn and so adamant about trying to interview the Children of Liberty and then Agent Liberty himself, and yet he was surprised that that guy used the word roaches in front of him. Like, how do you ask a racist not to use, like, derogatory terminology? Like, you know that's what they do, so I don't understand. It was just very naive of him to think he could change their minds in any capacity, and that's why his dumbass got kidnapped. So he really suffered from this character assassination that the episode put him through. And then Lena's argument made no sense. Why on earth do you think that giving humans powers is going to make everything better? So, like, evening the playing field sounds more like she's trying to go to war on her own terms than an actual solution for the Children of Liberty. They're already violent. We don't need to be giving anyone powers and hoping they won't do anything hurtful to anyone. And then what I also don't understand is Haley's stance on the Children of Liberty. I know she doesn't like aliens, but the DEO is called the Department of Extranormal Operations. So shouldn't she be concerned with what's going on with aliens right in her backyard? And it makes no sense why she wouldn't think it's a top priority and only realize that it was after the whole public purge mess. And speaking of the purge, that was really fucked up and reminiscent of Nazis. And I'm concerned that this show has really lost sight of what it is they're trying to do. And, like, are they condemning the Children of Liberty's actions, or are they giving them a bigger platform? Giving Ben his own show was the most realistic thing about this episode, but I also have to wonder whether or not they're concerned with showing the alien side at all because of the way that they've portrayed the whole thing so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely feel like, you know, we were promised alien stories when Kara said that she was going to start writing them, so I thought we'd at least get, like, her talking to one alien, like an alien of the week, after that at the end of, I guess it was last episode, and clearly that is not the case. There was, like, one line where she's like, well, I wrote those stories, and they were great. Everyone loves aliens now. Thank you. And that's that. I demand justice. But, like, to your point that they're, like, prioritizing the POV of these crazy racists, it's like when you saw the Thanksgiving speech that Ben was giving to his family that was, like, also doubling as, like, a call to arms, a call to action episode title, har har har, for the crazies. I was just like, yes, I see that you're trying to show that it's creepy and he's creepy, but it's also like, here's even more of his POV, right? Here's even more justification for what they're doing, even though we're, like, telling you it's wrong, but it's just as much we're telling you it's wrong, just like we're telling you that Manchester torturing that one guy is wrong, you know?
And he believes they're not a hero in this situation. And yeah, we're seeing anything that's, you know, really saying that he's not, or that he has, like, a delusional point of view. So it's just like, you know, what are you really doing?
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like they're very much both, like, they are both sizing it in the narrative, too. Even with the way that they're portraying Manchester versus the way that they're portraying Ben. So yeah, everything about James Lena in this episode bothered me. She wants to get human superpowers because, you know, giving privileged people even more privilege will now make them be nice to the people they're persecuting, right? It's like, that's why we should maintain the wage gap, I guess. Because otherwise, men might be offended. Or white people might be offended, right? I don't know. Who knows what will happen if we make it equal? It'll be really bad. So anyway. And he's also, James is ignoring his actual job and ignoring his boss, trying to make friends with violent racists because hashtag not all humans. Instead of exposing a hate group and actually using his platform for good. Like I said, like, if he had gone on that show, he probably would have just agreed with every fucking thing that Ben said. So it's a good thing that he didn't go on that show. And the, you know, Guardian Corps pseudo-breakup was just so dumb. Like, I was just like, when he said that thing, like, oh, well, that's not the kind of love that I want, or whatever, right? Which is like, I'll cross any line to protect you. But that's kind of like, how is he not going to justify what Lena's doing, but then justify the Children of Liberty, when they're also just, like, crossing lines to protect what they love, right?
Right. So,
what's the difference? I don't know. He agrees with them, but not with Lena. Doesn't make any sense. Anyway, I don't even care that his dumbass got kidnapped. Like, it's not like I wanted to die. I just wanted them to fix his storyline. And also fix Lena's storyline. And revert them back to the people they were before this storyline started. Because I don't like what they've become. the end.
Yeah. I like everything about in this episode was just like eye roll inducing. And then there's also, you know, Alex in Neo, like, didn't she get a promotion? Like, isn't she supposed to be, like, the director? Isn't she supposed to be in charge? And yet it feels like she has the exact same role this year as she did last year, except now she's taking, you know, orders from...
from a meaner boss.
Yeah, from a meaner boss. And, like, and Haley's attempts to control Alex's car seem like a bit much. Like, she's... she always has to backtrack in the end anyway, so, like, doesn't she get tired of, like, just being wrong all the time? Like, just let them do it up front. Making yourself all this, like, back and forth and then not listening to what you say anyway. That's my lighter dislike first before I really get to James and Lena. Like, the writers, they really did say, fuck a James Olsen, basically, in this episode. And what's worse is that I low-key/high-key think McCod thinks that this is a good storyline and that this is, you know, like he really? You know, it's like, yeah, we're doing something here. And I'm like, you're really not, boo. Like, this is not a good look. In fandom, it's not like James has the biggest fan base in the world to begin with, but this storyline is not impressing anyone except probably MAGA folks, honestly. Like, he's arguing with Lena the whole episode. It was just dumb. He claims he doesn't need her interfering, and yet when he does something on his own, like ignoring her and going to interview domestic terrorists instead of doing his job, he is immediately kidnapped. So, and then even before that, if it were up to just James getting himself out of jail, like, he'd still be in jail. Like, Lena is the one that got him out. So clearly, Lena does need to babysit him or something, because he's not doing shit on his own that he thinks he's doing. And I feel like, you know, having her tell James that she did it because she loved him and wants to protect him, and him rejecting that love was just not a good look. Like, it just kind of, like, I feel like it blew, like, a cannonball-sized hole in the Guardian Corps ship, and, like, the wood is just, like, rotting from the inside out. And, like, I don't know how you fix that, you know, because it's not like people, you know, you have a whole Super Corps fan base that are already, like, I don't want y'all together anyway, and then you have James tell Lena, like, your love is not worthy. You know, it's just not a good look, I think. And then, you know, James is not
100%.
James is not completely to blame. Like, Lena's not off the hook in this episode either, in terms of stupidity. Like, while I agree that Lena, that the Children of Liberty are terrorists and that James should have disavowed them, distanced himself as guardian from them by now. She also had moments where she didn't make any sense. It's like the writers keep flip-flopping on her stance, depending on whatever they need her, like, they still need her to do something, like, morally questionable for reasons, because she could go bad. And so, you know, even though they're like, Lena's staunchly against Children of Liberty, but Lena's also like, you know what, a reasonable solution to stopping hateful humans from attacking aliens is to give humans superpowers. And it's like, that's like saying the way to end gun violence is to just throw more guns at the situation. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, well, obviously you wouldn't give them to bad people. I'm like, how do you know who the bad people are? They're like, how? How do you even do that? So, like, it's, you know, I feel like if this Lena storyline was not connected to the Children of Liberty theme, it would be very much more Lena-esque. I feel like this is something that she would do, but the fact that they are also trying to do this whole Children of Liberty hate storyline, it doesn't work, because you can't have Lena both on both sides of, well, this is bad, but also I still want to do this. So they just keep kind of flip-flopping on, you know, putting Lena on one side or the other, depending on whether they want her to be the voice of good against James versus still morally questionable in giving humans powers so they can be on level playing field with aliens. And then lest I forget to mention those hateful fucking balls of non-sunshine, like the Children of Liberty, surprise, surprise, I hated them. I hated seeing them run around inflicting more violence on aliens than the actual aliens themselves. Seeing those aliens' point of view, I thought, like, the racist that James was walking with, and the dog, the whole, everything about the dog, like, pointing out aliens and barking at houses. And that was just super, super fun and triggering, by the way. Like, you go back into, like, especially, like, the segregated South and the way the police use dogs to lash out against, like, black people. And, like, what May was saying was, you know, the way that houses were marked by Nazis to find Jewish homes. It's all just very triggering for this purge party. And it's just... This is, like, beyond angry because the alien took my job. You know, that's, you can't even use that as, like, an excuse anymore. And so I hate that no one with authority or, like, voice or influence besides Kara is willing to do something about it publicly. So, like, it's just all gross. Predictions? What do we predict about how ugly this is going to get? I guess I'll say that now that racists are training dogs to spot aliens, I want to know what Kara is going to do if she comes across one of these dogs as Kara Danvers and not Supergirl. Because, you know, like, what if she's out with Lena somewhere and, like a racist dog spotter comes up and starts, like, barking at her, trying to attack her. And that's how the Children of Liberty find out that Kara is an alien. And then, you know, I wonder if that's how she's going to get exposed, quote-unquote. So that's a little bit worrying. And then, like, I feel like this episode we saw Nia being really, really cagey about her narcolepsy. So we had someone respond to, like, that Nia Dreamer ask that we had on Tumblr. And I was like, well, I don't know that she knows that's what she's doing. And then I was like, I think she's doing it intentionally. And now seeing this episode, I'm like, maybe she is doing it intentionally. Like, she is aware of what she's doing. Because I don't know otherwise why she'd be so cagey about the lies about seeing a doctor.
I agree that Nia might know about her abilities to a degree because the way she reacted to Eliza, and I would like to predict optimistically that we'll eventually start seeing more alien stories, but my optimism has gone out the window, so I got nothing.
I agree with Jessica that, and her Anon, that Nia knows because she was being real weird about it. Unless she just looks really embarrassed about her narcolepsy and doesn't want to go to the doctor, you know? Because at first... Yeah, it seemed like what she immediately was like, yeah, I have it. Like, it seemed like that was genuine, but then when she was being cagey with Eliza, it was like, So,
yeah. Moving on to Arrow. This week in Slabside, it becomes even more dangerous after a guard is murdered and everyone is a suspect. Felicity enlists the help of Anatoly in her pursuit of Diaz, and Laurel flexes her muscles as the district attorney. We have, and also in the flash forwards, William and Roy and Zoe and Dinah get one step closer to unraveling the Felicity secret. They go deeper into the rabbit hole, and their next step is to find someone called Black Star to possibly get help figure out what happened to Felicity. So Kristen Wendell directed this episode, and it was written by Sarah Tarkoff and Tanya Kong. What did we like about Arrow this week?
I kind of like that Renee sold out Felicity and Laurel about the torture. Like, he wasn't about to go down with them for their bad decisions. He's like, been there, done that, I'm moving on. I also really liked Laurel's journey this episode and how passionate she was about trying to get Oliver out of jail and then trying to have him be seen as a hero in front of the judge despite his flaws and past was really commendable. And I like that it paralleled her own journey. And I was cheering for her as well during that last scene when she told Oliver off because he really deserved it for being an asshole to her. Felicity trying to make Laurel feel better and saying they'll still take down Diaz together was nice because it made it seem that even though the rest of the team was against her working with them, Felicity wasn't, so she hasn't forgotten about her. I like the group scene a lot that started with all of them meeting at Anatoly's location and then ended with them fighting about what they should do was really nice. And it had, like, comedic elements, and it was hilarious when Curtis brought up his birthday and then Felicity spoiled his surprise and told him to act surprised. And finally, the flash-forward seemed like they're really, like, slowly starting to come together, and I did like that Roy was protective of William and immediately told him that he didn't owe Felicity anything and that William and Zoe got to chat.
Yeah, I have to admit that the flashbacks were really intriguing, and, like, I want to know what went down, like, what fractured the team so badly, what made Felicity turn this cold, where the hell is Oliver, why isn't William with him? when did Zoe and William become estranged besties? Like, when did the besties become estranged in the first place? So many questions. I'm very excited. I'm finally, like, ready for more about that. I also really like that Anatoly made it out alive this episode. Let's touch and go there for a second. A couple of seconds. There was a couple different times where I was like, Anatoly, you gotta make it through, man. So, yay. I'm real happy for him. Laurel doing her best to get Oliver out of jail. I really like that, like, her wanting to turn over a new leaf, wanting to prove that she can be a good person, and also really wanting to be a real lawyer, right? And I just really like this Laurel 2.0. I think she's trying really hard, and it's really nice to see her developing a genuine friendship with Felicity, to see them working together. Like, finally we've got women on the show actually talking to each other, actually holding lengthy conversations, like Dinah, realizing that Laurel actually does have a heart and that she can be a hero as long as she takes that hard path. And Laurel's still feeling guilty of what she did to Dinah's man, whose name I've forgotten. Vince. And bringing it up, like, you know, you of all people know what I'm like. And she's like, yeah, but, you know, you keep telling me you've changed, so prove it to me. And I love it. It gave me the skills.
Yay!
I also love that she did manage to get a prison investigator for abuses. So that's really important. Shows that you can get some things done the legal way. And not only that, but she stopped Felicity from killing Diaz. Again, she's actually becoming the moral center for people that were previously moralizing to her. And instead provided that leverage. And Felicity's relief when he was coming home was one of, I think, Emily's better moments, acting-wise, that I really liked. And then, finally, I agree that the Big Green Squad was cute. You know, I hate seeing Laurel denigrated, but I enjoyed the little back and forth, especially about Curtis' birthday. And the fight choreography stays on point.
Yeah. Laurel, like, I was really cheering for her this entire episode. I liked all things Laurel. My little Sour Patch trying her best to be a good person. It was really, you know, cute to see her at first, like, really feel like she was a part of something, you know, starting with, like, the partnership with Felicity and working to get Oliver out of jail, and, you know, when she first went to see Oliver, she was really, like, pumped, like, yeah, I'm gonna do this, and, you know, to be kind of turned down a little bit, well, a lot of it by Oliver was like, oh, you know, she's trying her best, so, like, I was really cheering for her, and I like, really like that you see lately she's trying to come out of her hardened shell. Like, it's starting to soften a little bit. She's starting to find, you know, come to think of Star City and Earth One as her new home. So that's really nice to see her kind of coming into that. Felicity is, like, her first real friend in this world. And I feel like she's slowly adapting to being, like, less murdery and figuring out what it means to be an Olivia Pope wearing the white proverbial hat. And she is kind of Olivia Pope in you because she's wearing, like, a lot more white. Recently. I think that one and on kind of mentioned, like, you know, whenever we see her and Dinah together, like, Dinah's in black and she's in white, and they're kind of the same, like, yin-yang versions of each other. But I like that, and I kind of wonder if, for one reason, it's like that she wears white because Dinah's the black canary and she's kind of white to contrast Dinah, or if it also is referring to that kind of Olivia Pope-ness of justice and, you know, being the advocate for justice by wearing, like, the white hat kind of thing. So I thought that was cool. And I feel like what started out as a cover of convenience to take on E1 Laurel's spot has turned into, like, a passion of her own, which is really nice to see. Her defense of Oliver in court and her speech about how the hardest thing to do is be a hero when no one expects you to be, I thought was really moving, and it really spoke to what she was going through as well. And I feel like it moved Dinah enough to see that side of her, and because of that, she was able to stop Laurel from, you know, going full siren on the judge because she lost. Like, she had a setback, and Dinah's like, you had a setback, it's not the end of the world, you know, you are on this harder path, but, you know, stick with it kind of thing. So I like seeing that conversation between them, and Dinah being the one to kind of, you know, bring her back, bring Laurel back from what could have been, you know, a slip, and her being this new Laurel. So, like, my crack ship says, feed me grade A good shit material. I love it. and, like, you guys said, like, the big debrief among, like, the former Team Arrow squad and all of their bickering and like, going back and forth about, you know, why did you do this? Why you did that? You know, kind of blaming each other was really funny. And it had great, hilarious comedic timing, especially from Katie Cassidy when everyone was, like, throwing digs at Laurel. She's like, I'm still here. I'm in the room when you were saying the stuff. Buffy is kind of, you know, she is trying, like, she's just trying to be part of the group, like, stop, like, pushing her out kind of thing. And then in the flash forward, I like seeing Zoe and William catch up, even though, like you said, like, when did they have this bestie relationship when they were kids? Because you never see them together. But it's nice that, you know, in the future, like, you get the kind of shared bonds as a family, and, you know, the only thing is, like, where the fuck is JJ? Like, round out the shield, please. Is he? Okay, never mind.
Actually, I forgot to mention, Tasha mentioned that they should have, like, a superhero playdate. Like, why don't we see that happening in the present? Yeah.
So, and I like that we learn more about Felicity in the future, although I don't necessarily like what we actually learned. I like that we, more of that mystery is unfurling. So that's cool. What did we not like about this episode?
I actually felt really bad for Anatoly this episode because Felicity didn't give a shit about his life for, like, a few minutes. And, like, I don't like that Felicity's basically walking down this dark road without even stopping to think about it very much. Like, she asked Anatoly, what would Oliver do? And he's like, you know what he would do. And, of course, she already knew the answer because she knew Oliver. So I don't like that they're essentially trying to make her out to be a female Oliver at this point. So I'm very concerned with the way they're presenting it and where they're going with this. And I also don't like how rude Oliver was to Laurel, especially telling her to stay away from his wife as if his wife didn't recruit her to help her. And this was definitely the more controlling part of him. And what's even more messed up is that it made it seem like Felicity couldn't make the decision with working with Laurel on her own. And also that he was trying to defend Laurel to Dinah last season and then worked with her briefly, but now can't stand that she's trying to help him. So I think that was kind of dumb. And then finally, Stanley turning out to be shady. Like, why are we all not surprised? Oliver's prison storyline continues to disappoint, though. And, I was bored trying to watch him figure out who it was that killed the guard. And I don't think it's made much of an impact on him as a person. And that makes the whole thing kind of less satisfying.
Yeah, my general feeling about the prison storyline is just shut up, Stanley. I don't care about your secretly evil ass. I'm glad that he's finally secretly evil. At first, it's like, oh, he seems like a fun little guy. And I was like, nope, he's a weirdo. Gotta go. And now I'm like, well, I'm glad that you are, in fact, a weirdo. And I barely remember who Turner is, even though I watched the episode twice. And the second time, I was like, I gotta remember who Turner is, because someone said Turner, and I was like, I don't know who that is. And I still don't know who that is.
Bronze Tucker.
Oh, see, I didn't know that was his real name. There you go. But still, that's how little I care about the storyline. I was like, all right, moving on. Like I said, like, the bickering scene was fun, but the one part that I find a little bit irritating was, like, the way that Diggle and Felicity talk to each other right now. Like, I know they're, like, on opposite sides of the thing, but I'm like, can y'all just, like, be friends, please? Because I'm tired. I'm tired of you both. Acting the way you are. That's all. And also, yeah, like, Felicity not caring about Anatoly's life was a little bit upsetting. But I did like, this could be in my likes, but I'm putting in my dislikes, just in general, I don't like the progress towards cold Felicity. But I like when he told her that apologizing means she hasn't really changed. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, like, you gotta go all the way, right? Or not right at all. So, yeah, that's all.
That's an interesting way to turn that around. Yeah, I feel less bad that Oliver let Stanley get beat to a pulp.
He had the right idea all along. Yeah,
he had it coming.
We have to apologize for Oliver because we were so mad that he let Stanley get beat up. And now
we thought he was Barry Allen 2.0 and it turned out to be a lie.
He like, who's the fool right now?
Yeah. I don't like Stanley at all. I think he's annoying. He gets on my nerves. I don't know why Oliver has to be attached to Stanley and only Stanley. Like, Stanley is his only friend in prison, and I think that's blinding him at this point and clouding his judgment. Again, like, my dislikes about the prison storyline, my gripes about it. Like, I wish there was more of, like, if Oliver could have been, like, an in-prison detective, like, you know, like, John is, like, the alien detective. When stuff goes wrong, aliens come to John. Mm-hmm. I wish there, and because, like, Sob Slag is apparently so corrupt, I wish there were more problems, like, multiple prisoners in the prison that have, like, different inmates bring him, like, cases. Or, like, he finds that something, like, this inmate is being accused of something, and he has to, like, solve it this week. So, like, he could be more effectively reforming prison from the inside out and not just worrying about himself and now his little buddy Stanley, who isn't even worth his protection in the first place. And then, like, I don't like his judginess. Like, he's still very judgy. And I get why he wouldn't, but still, just when Stanley comes back and name drops Turner's Blade, and he's like, how did you know about that? Revealing himself to be shady. I was like, well, see, you should listen to Turner. Like, he told you didn't do it. So it's kind of like a, you know, it still kind of, it turned me off because he, like, Oliver very much wanted it to be Turner and to RCB Brick. And so again, it's like clouding his judgment on how he makes decisions. And then paralleling in my dislikes, I also didn't like Felicity's story. I don't really like Ruthless Felicity. I didn't mind her strong-arming Anatoly into helping them. I thought that was good strategically for her to do. But I did have a problem with her lying to him that he wasn't in danger when he actually was. And then caring, like, even when he almost died, she cared more about they got the information on the drive than she did about his life and safety in that moment. So I do think it was good that she came back and apologized and, like, a little bit course-corrected, like, she wasn't bad all the way, and she got him out in the end to the Maldives. But I don't like the fact that, you know, Arrow is taking his heroes down these dark-ass paths, and seeing the Flash Wars and seeing how she wants in the future, it doesn't really seem like she's gonna come out of it. So it's gonna be a little bit depressing to watch her just, like, fall deeper into, like, the darkness. And then lastly, Laurel trying her best to be part of the team. You know, like I said, I just felt really bad for her when everyone kept, like, knocking her down. Especially, like, Oliver. You know, and again, I can understand, like, Oliver hasn't seen everything that Laurel's been doing since he's been in jail. But, again, like, he was kind of an asshole. Like, you're not really in a position to pick and choose where your help comes from, Oliver. So, like, I didn't think it was great that he kind of shut her out when she was trying to help him. And then on top of that, her being kicked out of the Cash Diaz group and shaded by everybody was just like, you know,
sad. Let Laurel be great.
Let Laurel be great, great people. Predictions.
Oliver will be out of prison by the next episode. It gives him time to get time with himself and have reunite with everyone right before the crossover starts. That's it.
I'm on the free Turner train right now, so I hope Oliver holds on to his suspicion of family and works to get Turner out of the hole as, like, his last little thing of prison community service before he gets released. And then I was thinking, like, back when you were talking about Tasha's feedback, like, maybe Maya could be Black Star. I don't know.
That does make sense. I mean, presumably Black Star's a person, right?
Yeah. Right. I feel like if it was JJ, then Zoe would know JJ was Black Star. But if she's someone new, and I do agree that Maya is someone in the future, maybe she's Black Star and working with Felicity. So that's my prediction.
It's a solid, solid prediction.
Okay. Moving on to Legends of Tomorrow. Legends of Tomorrow summary. A new fugitive is on the loose in 1951 Tokyo, and Sarah, Zari, Rory, and Charlie try to go capture it. As Constantine struggles to recover, Ray knows that magic might be the only thing that can save him, but must look outside the team for help. AKA, he must find the love of his life, more dark, and use Constantine's near-death experience to coax her back into his life. Meanwhile, Ava joins Nate in the worst family Thanksgiving dinner ever. Meanwhile, while they're at Nate's house, Gary's trying to set up a date with him and Mona, but things go awry when all of the monsters that they have tranquilized in the storage room wake up very hungry and very angry and very, very hangry. So this episode was directed by Lexi LaRoche and written by Kido Shimizu and Uba Muhammad. What did we like about this episode?
Would you like to go first?
I really liked how they incorporated the horrors of Hiroshima and how, you know, they exploited experiences, like how traumatic experiences can influence the creative process. I liked how they showed, you know, that the creative process can also be an outlet for rewriting your own ending, right? Like, and that imagination can be as cruel or as kind as you want it to be, right? And you can use it, like, it wasn't, in the end, it wasn't really the book that was evil. It was you what you put into it is what you get out of it, right?
Right.
I thought that Ashiro was a really interesting character, and I really liked how empathetic Sarah was towards him, and I liked that that earned Charlie's respect, and then in turn, Charlie saved Sarah, which earned Sarah's respect, so now we can finally start treating Charlie like a human being. I cannot wait. I thought that Zari was really great at playing a 1950s Hollywood executive. I really enjoyed that little moment where she was, like, thanking, like, oh, can we get a tour? Oh, like, we want to get see your footage. That was really cool. I love her. I love everything she does, except for when she's asshole to Charlie. I don't like that. Anyway, moving on. I like her lifting Nick up, like, him bonding with the book, and then coming up with a story, finally, like, getting over his writer's block. Yeah, so all of that was great. Onto the Nora Constantine Ray side, I thought that Ray defending Nora's honor and then getting a smack for his efforts was, like, really cute. I really like their interactions. I like that she was treated with respect by the narrative in this episode, that both Ray and Constantine gave her the space to, like, make the decision that she wanted to make about magic, and that we got to see her bring up her father, bring up, you know, the second chance he gave her, and how she's actually trying to live her life. I guess there's a little bit of a parallel to Laurel, except that in this episode, people were supportive of that, right? Even Constantine, who was previously a jerk about it to Ray, when he saw Nora, was much better. And I really like that Ray figured out how she can use magic without hurting anyone, like, by using that little lightning rod type thing. LOL, lightning rod. It's not really, you know what I'm saying. But anyway. It's a nice example of, you know, why they are actually good for each other. Like, she turned herself in because he inspired her, right? And she helps him loosen up, right? Because he'll break some rules for her. James Olsen would not like that. So, I was super emo with the music. Apparently the song is Girl by Time Cop, 1983, and Sea Waves. And it was so good. I was still at her mom. Yeah, it was so good. And I like that we got a little glimpse of Constantine's heartache, you know, to wrap that all up. As for Thanksgiving storyline, the only things that I really liked were that we got a little bit more exploration of Ava and how she feels like she doesn't have a real family, right? And how she wants to experience other people's families because of that. And Mona being the encyclopedia of the knowledge of creature eating habits was super fun. So I was like, that's a random thing for you to know about, but cool. And then finally, the CGI for Tegumo and Harima were, you know, good in terms of, like, they really fit the legend style. They looked not, like, particularly realistic, but they looked like good legends, like, it felt great, fit the tone. And that I liked Ashiro filming the final battle. Like, it was really cool. Like, oh, he's gonna put that in his movie, yay! The end.
Yeah. I really liked that Charlie finally got to be free and join the team on their mission. Like, I think the magical creature story this week was really good, and the speech Hiro gave about his experience, like Tati said, during Hiroshima was very tragic and very moving. And it's very rare that we get to see this perspective from any of the Hiroshima survivors in America, in American media, because the country would rather kind of ignore that we did it. So this was like a nice surprise, and I think they handled it well by also tying it into the creature of the week. And then the idea that stories can be written and then rewritten is good commentary on both fiction and history. And I'm really glad that they remember that Mick can write stories and that they used it to their advantage here. I enjoyed seeing how supportive Zari was of his writing and how she kind of waited until he was ready to tell Sarah about his secret without outing him herself, kind of like she did with Ray. So Zari is like the keeper of everyone's secrets, and she does it so well. Please protect her. Charlie saving Sarah was great and will probably make Sarah trust her now moving forward, which will be a nice change of pace. And I really enjoyed Nora's storyline this episode. I think we were all worried last week that she wouldn't get to have her own perspective and be part of a one-sided story from Ray's perspective. But I'm glad that we were proven wrong. And I like that Constantine told her that she had a choice in the matter with regards to using her magic to save him. And I like that she struggled with the idea of using her magic in general because she was trying to be better and honor her father's sacrifice for her and also not fall back into her old ways. But then she went and decided that saving someone's life was more important, and she did it for herself just as much as she did it for Constantine and Ray. And I like that not all magic is bad was reintroduced. And hopefully she and Charlie can actually bond because in the future, at least, because then they can kind of have the same idea going on in the show about how it's how you use the magic and not magical people that are inherently evil. And then finally, I'm not going to lie, Ray and Nora do have a lot of chemistry, and I like their interactions, and I look forward to seeing what the show does with them down the line.
It's nice that, you know, people that are married in real life, because obviously they have chemistry to get married, also have chemistry on screen.
Yeah,
so,
it's weirdly rare in the Arrowverse. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I don't know what it is.
Well, not even in the Arrowverse. It is not always the case in general.
Yeah.
You know, couples that are in love in real life, that doesn't always translate on screen. Mm-hmm. So,
And theirs does, which is really nice. Because they're so cute together. But I love, like, I live in Tokyo, for those of you that did not know. And so when I saw that they were going to be in Tokyo, I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. And I love that right off the bat, they use a Japanese Legends of Tomorrow logo for the beginning of the show. I thought it was a great way to introduce, like, the story. And that the fact that we're going to, like, Tokyo's version of Hollywood and, like, movie and TV making, so they use, like, the Japanese logo, which is great. I agree with you that Zari made, like, an excellent Hollywood scout agent. Like, she's really good. She really got into character, and I thought it was really a nice, I don't know, surprising, maybe. Yeah, kind of use of, like, her skills and her acting. So it was good to see that side of her. I liked walking around, like, the Tokyo Hollywood set and hearing Honda-san explain, like, how movies were made in Japan, like, and the techniques that they use. For example, like, when they make the kaiju movies, which kaiju means, like, the monster movies, using, like, city replicas and shooting from the ground level so everything looks bigger. You can tell, like, a lot of thought went into creating the world of Tokyo 1951, because usually, like, the legends are just, like, plopped into a time period that they don't really interact with, but I like that there was a lot of thought and, like, the whole concept and technique of movie making in Japan was incorporated in everything about this episode on the Tokyo side, so I thought that was really nice. I was particularly moved by Honda's story about the bomb drop in Hiroshima and how that affected him so much, and especially, like, this description that he gave, you know, like, there's just ash everywhere surrounding him in the air and in the city, and then realizing that ash is actually, like, people that died, and how, like, traumatizing that is. And I remember, because I actually, when I studied abroad in Osaka several years ago, and one of my breaks, I went to Hiroshima, and I went to the museum there that was talking about, like, the bomb, you know, there's things, like, on the walls, shadows of people, mm-hmm. where people used to be, like, you know, like, the...
Oh, my gosh.
When the bomb dropped, and you have, like, that light or whatever, and it imprinted shadows of people onto, like, buildings and walls, and you think about, like, that used to be a person, and that's all that's left, and it's just very, like, very deep, and very, like, you know, kind of shocking, and when you go and you see, like, how this actually affected people here. And I like that was something that was brought into and not glossed over on the episode. And, you know, how creating Tagumo was his way of putting that terror and that trauma of everything he experienced into something that he could understand. Like, this Tagumo was this, was, like, the monster that destroyed his city. So I thought that was really well connected together. I like that the magical creature wasn't actually a magical creature at all, but a book, and that the book wasn't actually evil, but rather a gift to humans from, like, a goddess to stoke creativity and art. So, kind of the same, it kind of parallels Nora in the sense that, you know, she's also magical, but she's not evil. This Charlie is magical, but Charlie's not evil. This book is magical, but this book is not evil. So, again, you have that kind of paralleling of, you know, it's not, magic isn't inherently evil, but it's how you use it kind of thing that May mentioned. I like that they were able to bring in Mick's seemingly random hobby of writing back into the forefront and have that serve a purpose with him kind of being the hero of this episode and rewriting the Tagumo story so that Tokyo wasn't destroyed. I like that they trusted Charlie enough to put Charlie in the field and that she was more useful than Sarah probably thought that she would be. And then back on the Wave Rider with Nora and Ray, they made, like, a really good team. It was corny, very cliche, but it was very totally, like, Ray thing for him to save Nora from the pervy Renaissance guy. Because he's, like, literally is that knight in shining armor type of guy. and they're, like you said, like, they're just so cute together, and, John was softer to Nora than I thought he would be, which is really a nice surprise. I like how helping was, you know, he's like, do it for you. She chose to save him for herself, and Ray was there to help her figure out a way to save John without, like, her hurting anybody. But it really, really hit me. And the song may have had something to do with it. But at the end, when Ray was like, you have to go, run, be free. But she, like, takes the strap later and takes them both to, like, Time Bureau because she's like, I want to turn myself in because I want to be a good person. And I want to, like, honor, like, my father and, you know, you for what you did for me. And I was just like, I'm crying right now. This is really sad. This is so angsty. It's just, like, really nice to see her, you know, turn herself in because she wants to be a good person. And part of that is owning up to the things that she did. And then lastly, my OTP, Sorry and Food.
It lives on.
What did we dislike about this episode?
Oh, I forgot that there were things that we disliked. So, I love Charlie. I'm glad people stopped treating her like shit, but it was really annoying watching it happen this episode. Like, Sarah was, like, talking back about everything that she said, and Zari was like, oh, I hope that, you know, I would rather see you in a cage. And I was like, this is so weird. I don't like it. Stop this. So, yeah, I'm glad it's over, but it was very annoying that it happened for, like, 3 episodes. Alright, the entire Thanksgiving plot was just dumb. I don't care. I don't care about any family. And, like, yes, there's a couple lines from Ava, but aside from, like, they could have just been said at any point in any other situation than having to watch Nate's dumb family and Nate's dumb dad, who is also secretly plotting something relating to magical creatures that I also do not care about. So, ixnay. Also, even the Gary and Mona thing is weird, because I don't know, it's, you know, like, I think that they're cute, but then I'm like, I don't know that, does he even have a crush on her, or is he just an awkward person? And does she have any feelings about him whatsoever? Or is she just like, yes, I will eat some Thanksgiving food? I don't know. Is it like a friendship? Is it just like, is she a secret spy? I don't So, whatever. Okay. I like that Nate, that Mick saved the day with his writing. But his, like, brand of humor is still just, like, overkill for me. I am just a Mick hater. I'm sorry. Like, Legends usually does a great job balancing heart and ridiculousness. But, like, with Mick, you've got, like, he's, like, deuce-dropping jokes, right? Creating 3-breasted heroines, making passionate love to them in front of everyone. Like, he is, like, Ralph on The Flash last season to me, except that it's like if Ralph was still exactly the same as last season, but only showed up for 5 minutes an episode. So it's, like, contained, but I still wanted Gong whenever it's there. And also, I didn't like that little, like, planting the idea for Godzilla or whatever that he did at the end there. I was like, I'm sure they would have come up with Godzilla without me. Like, what? Anyway, so that's all.
Yeah.
At least if he had just been like, oh yeah, you should think about a lizard, and then like, LOL, moving on. But instead they really had him be like, oh my god. Oh! And I'm like, so I was like, okay, whatever. Stupid.
Yeah. I agree about the mix-up. I saw, I was like, is that a 3-breasted woman? Like, why? But in general, I wasn't a fan of Nate's Thanksgiving storyline either. Like, I don't think it really did much in furthering the relationship between him and his dad. And it felt more like they were just giving him and Ava something to do on the side before they had to deal with what was going on at the Time Bureau. And I'm also not impressed that Nate's dad was revealed to have ulterior motives, because God forbid we have a parent-child relationship without having one of them be evil or keep secrets. And I personally might have missed this, because I don't remember when Mona decided to help Gary and Nate, because that part just confused me. Maybe I looked down, maybe something happened while I was, I don't know. And speaking of her helping them, I think this is a strange way to introduce her, unless she really does have something she's hiding and she's secretly trying to find out more about the magical creatures for her own reasons that she hasn't told anyone yet.
Yeah, and I wish if that was the case, we could actually see that from her a little bit, because right now she just seems like very, you know, a little bit airhead, kind of happy to be here. Oh, this is cool! And I forgot to mention in my likes, so I did like, I thought Ava was pretty funny, like, trying to figure out how to function in this, like, dysfunctional Thanksgiving family dinner. And I thought Mona's really cute, and how she's helpful with all the food stuff, but I do think it is kind of a weird way to bring her into the Time Bureau just because she knows food, and explaining that, how she knows what magical creatures eat because she reads a lot, like, it's a little bit flaky, flimsy, and if there is nothing else to Mona other than she knows food, then that's kind of a little bit disappointing, because I feel like we thought that her, when she's still Alaska Young, that her knowledge was going to be a little bit deeper than that. So this is kind of like a different way. I didn't think they were going to go that way with her character. Thanksgiving storyline, you know, it's, I guess they just needed like a Thanksgiving theme, but the whole takeaway with Nate's dad being secretly evil, or not evil, but having like the whole government using monsters agenda was disappointing, especially since it meant so much to Nate that he thought he finally connected with his dad and they have something in common. Charlie and John, they literally have the same accent. They have the same, they're from the same part of Britain. Charlie's role is magical creatures expert, which is also John's role of magical creatures expert. So they're literally like doubling up on the same personality role on the team. It feels like they're doubling up on the same character, and I'm glad that they were separated in this plot, because it's just way too much like British, like, bloke and wanker for me. Like, if they ever get together and just have, like a Brit-off, it's gonna be, like, a lot. And, like you guys said, I also don't like or get why Charlie and Zari don't get along and butt heads all the time. And I kind of wonder if it's because, like, I don't know if maybe Zari's jealous that she's not the baby legend anymore and Charlie's, like, the new child on the team or something. I don't know, but I wish you could get to the bottom of that, because that's kind of bothering me. That's the only dynamic that's really kind of bothering me right now, because I don't feel like that's Zari. So but that leads into predictions. What else do you predict about the future of Legends season 4?
I feel like my only prediction is that Nora knows, I've already said this, you know, the name of the demon. Like, knows the demon that Constantine, and that will somehow tie back into the you know, creature plot. That's all I got.
Do you know who the, because I didn't watch Constantine when it was a show on its own, so who the guy in the flashback was?
I don't think it's part of the show. No, it's in between. It's something that happened after the show ended, before Legend started.
Great. So,
and in fact, I think it's something that happened after the last time we saw Constantine on Legends.
Okay.
Or not the last time, but, you know, the time that he ended up with Sarah. It was something that happened after the time he ended up with Sarah on Legends.
I do not have anything.
So now it's time for side 8, huh? Ladies and gentlemen of the week. Supergirl, Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow.
Well, I think this is one time that... Oh, no. I have two nominations. Would anyone like to go first with theirs?
This is hard. Let's see. I want to nominate Laurel.
Yes.
Because I think that she's really trying to be a good person, and this episode really was a major step forward for her. Like, her backing up someone, trying to be part of a team who doesn't even want her, and then trying to back up a guy who doesn't like her. And trying to be helpful and show that there are different sides to people and they're not just one thing. And I think that was very, very brave of her to do.
I agree.
So I would also put Nora on here for a nomination, because she didn't have to go back. It was a really big risk for her to take to save John's life using magic, knowing, you know, because she kind of seemed... related her magic to, like, being an alcoholic in the sense that she didn't want to, like, backslide and go back down the wrong path after she was trying so hard to be good. But I like that she was able to come to a decision that she wants to try and use her magic for good, and that she was successful in that. And then also at the end, even more than her just saving Dawn, her just deciding not to run away from her past and giving herself up to the Time Bureau. I thought it was very noble of her.
I definitely agree. I was going to say that Nora was my other one. And you both, ladies, those are my two choices. So, those are my nominations.
And then I don't think it's as strong as the other two, but I would like to give Kara credit on Supergirl for going on the talk show and speaking out for aliens and their point of view. she had to go up against, like, Lockwood. So I thought that like,
she acquitted herself admirably.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
She can be our honorable mention.
Yes. Now I'm on side B. Insert nice pun here. Never too late for Jesus. Monster. So, first we are going to start out with Flash. The summary of this episode, Caitlin, Barry, and Cisco learn something new about Caitlin's father, Thomas Snow. Meanwhile, Iris and Nora and Sherlock follow a clue about Cicada, while Seal is feeling kind of out of practice from her DA days. And so she partners up with Ralph to tackle down another lead about Cicada. Also, speaking of Cicada, he's also still out killing metas and doing stuff and speaking gruffly to his doctor friends, getting stronger. This episode was directed by Chris Pepe and written by Kristen Kim, which I can promise you explains a hell of a lot. And her writing partner was Josh Gilbert. So, this was quite an interesting episode.
If by interesting you mean boring, but there were a couple of things to like. Yeah. Nora wanting to voluntarily spend time with her mommy because she's now just as big a fan of hers as she is her dad's was adorable. And then Barry and Iris' face at Nora's excitement over a mother-daughter outing was precious. And Nora admitting she asked Joe about Iris' time as a speedster was really cute. And I like that we finally get to see them working together and finding the missing piece of the satellite. And speaking of the satellite, I'm glad that their reemergence, all four of them, hasn't limited the characters to Star Labs, so they're actually still leaving and going around doing their thing. And I also loved Iris and Nora's little attempt at a celebratory high five. That was cute. And then finally, Cecile and Ralph working together was a great team up, and I like that they got to explore a bit of Cecile wanting to get back out there. Like, she was on a mission to get her groove back. And it was nice to have Ralph supporting her. So I loved and laughed when he called her Cecilia Fate Horton, chuckled a couple times. But how Cecile got her groove back should have been the title of this episode.
Because I didn't even get the whole Cecilia Fate joke until I saw you write it out. I was like, oh!
Yeah, thank God for Pay and her captions. Because I didn't get it either. I thought he was literally saying her full name. Yeah. And I was like, what is her name? Well, your fate? So I'm so glad that May figured it out or had the captions on and wrote her down.
My caption saved the day.
it was very cute. It was very cute. Moving on, I'm glad, I guess. It's weird to say that I'm glad, but like, I guess it's good that we saw Cicada is still out there murdering some metas, so we know he's like just something, even though he and the team are not currently intersecting. Plus, I don't know why, like, I like that the doctor, like, cares so much about him and Grace, and is like, yes, I am aware that I'm violating, like, 300 hippocratic codes, medical laws, something, you know? But, you know, it's cool. I just want you guys to be happy. So, sorry, cool. I like this. Whatever's going on here. I'm so happy that Nora transferred some of her hero worship onto Iris this week. They were very adorable together. I wish we had seen more of them. They were super, super awkward, but it was really cute to watch. And I thought it was also fun that, like, Sherlock was, like, just really wanted to get the show on the road. But then once he realized that Nora just wanted to hang out with Mom, he just sat there and made tea for 2 hours so that they could bond, I guess. It was like, that's nice. And also, I guess, look at that sheet of paper. Look at that Ferris wheel advertisement that helped figure out the, you know, Cicada situation. I think they're also doing a good job of replacing Joe's screen time with Cecile. She's fitting in really well, and, like, they made it believable. Like, they're like, oh, Joe's out with the baby, so I'll help you. Like, sure, you know, why not? I love seeing her freaking out about losing her mojo, and I liked her consistently intimidating Ralph. And it was, I like that she and Ralph figure things out on the FEMA side, right? And then Iris, Sherlock, and Nora figure things out on their side so they can put together the Cicada puzzle pieces. Again, it's just too bad that we didn't get to see more of that. Things that I liked about the Caitlin storyline included Barry pointing out that Cisco is the one who cares the most about Caitlin. Because that is accurate. And Cisco complaining that these bitches make him do everything.
So, like, when I first was trying to think about what I liked about this episode, I was just like, you know, did anybody try the chicken? The chicken was lovely. Like, no? Okay. it was very difficult. And I, like, to be honest, work got really busy right when it's, and I would usually, like, be freaking out, but I missed, like, the first 10 minutes of this episode, and to be honest, I haven't even gone back to try and watch those 10 minutes. Yeah, because that's just how motivated I am to this episode this week. But the stuff that I do remember and that I saw clips of on YouTube that I liked, you know, Nora finally, like, being, like you said, like, opening up to Iris and, like, transferring some of that hero worship off of her dad onto her mom. It was like, who knew all Iris had to do was jump off a building to save her daughter's favorite parent to also become her daughter's favorite parent. Like, you know, that's all she had to do? Just jump off the okay. But I like that, you know, Nora was so excited to go out and that she wanted to be with her mother. And I even liked the kind of nonverbal looks between Iris and Barry. She's like, see, I'm the cool parent now. He's like, hell yeah, you are. I thought that was a really cute, like, nonverbal moment. And then, yeah, Ralph just, like, smiling like an idiot in the back. So, it was a nice kind of, like, family bonding thing to set everyone kind of be like, yay! Nora and Iris finally get to bond. And I like how kind of awkward they were with, like, trying to figure out what their speech report dynamic looked like out on the field. Then Sherlock, even though, like, he could have been a little bit more obvious with his head by the water side and not have him, like, stand there for 2 hours, but I feel like the reason that he did it was because, you know, he wanted to, you know, like, the whole saying, like, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make a drink. Like, he brought them to the water, but if he had just told them why they were there, then you wouldn't have gotten that kind of, like, back and forth between Iris and Nora, you know, putting together the clues and coming up with a plan and all that kind of stuff, which is really what he wanted them to do, which is because Nora wanted to bond with her mom and she couldn't figure out a way, so he, like, engineered a situation where they both got so annoyed waiting on him that they bonded working out the situation together and coming up with a plan to get the court. And I thought that was really, they could have figured it out, like, an hour and a half, or, like, he could have prodded them a little bit more, but I like that they eventually got to that point and were able to produce something that actually related to the main plot of figuring out who the kid is. I loved Ralph and Cecile working together, Detective Tall and Small. I liked her, you know, first when she's kind of, like, you know, she's, when they first go to meet the FEMA guy, and she's trying to be tough, she's, like, a little angry little kitten, it's, like, so cute. When she's trying to be, like, intimidating, she's just so cute. I like how they finally figured out what the real issue was, and it wasn't that she was lost her mojo, but she was just an empath picking up on his FEMA guy's feelings about being nervous, and using that to their advantage. And now that I know what Cecilia your fake Horton is actually a joke of, five times. I guess on the Caitlin side of things, I like that Tom is an asshole, and I like that he treated Barry, Cisco, and Caitlin like the idiots he thought they were. But I like that.
That's so sad.
Bring out your laundry list of things that you did not like about this episode. Who wants to start?
Oh my god. Oh my god. Well, I mean, repetition isn't a good look. So, like, last season, Iris basically told Caitlin that Killer Frost is still inside her at some point, and that she's not alone. So Caitlin had run several tests, so, like, why does she have to hear it again? My biggest pet peeve is that Caitlin constantly looks shocked about everything when there's no reason for it. Like, shocked Killer Frost was still inside her, even though she already knew that last season. Shocked her dad was actually a bad guy, even though that should have been obvious from the start. And shocked that the cold doesn't affect her, even though she should already know that. So, like, this episode had zero emotional buildup and absolutely no heart. There was also no point at all when I felt threatened by Thomas. no point when I felt sympathy at all for Caitlin's struggle, and no emotional payoff for when she finally got Killer Frost back. So the father-daughter reunion was painful, and the episode looked even worse coming after what was a great episode last week. And no reviewer wants to say it out loud, but Danielle is not a strong actress, and this episode proved once again that she cannot carry an entire episode on her own because the emotional range just isn't there. So paired that with lackluster writing just made it all the more obvious, so it was a struggle to watch her emote the entire time.
She doesn't have the range.
She does not have the range. There really wasn't much about this episode that made sense, and that's what was so frustrating about it. Like, who would believe that a dude who's been living in the North Pole all this time on his own had very little food? When did he even meet... 20 years.
He's up there for 20 years.
Like, that's mind-blowing. When did he even meet E.O. Wells? If E.O. Wells knew he was in hiding and gave him access to the cameras, why didn't he just leave the safe house at that point? And how are we just learning that Caitlin's dad had ALS? And Caitlin wasn't mad about him experimenting on her, but basically canceled her mom for all eternity just for being distant. So in this instance...
May, yes. Didn't know that he had ALS, but I don't blame you for not remembering that minor.
Right, deal. Like, it was whatever.
It was mentioned one time when she talked to Zoom, I think.
Okay. Yeah. That was ages ago. I've completely blocked that out. In this instance, like, he was knowingly experimenting on her on the off chance she would have ALS, even though she didn't have it at the time. And it's because of him that she has the power she never wanted to begin with, and yet she barely kind of batted an eye at it. And they were trying to parallel Caitlin's story to the West Allen family drama. They kind of... Actually, they didn't kind of. They failed really badly. It was also annoying that Caitlin yelled at Cisco and asked him to leave for trying to help her and look out for her. And this storyline, it was just so slow. It gave every other character little to do, even though their storylines were far more interesting and moved the plot. And it was just frustrating that everyone had to be sidelined or played dumb so that this plot could even work. Cicada's story moved forward, Nora and Iris were bonding, Sissy was trying to get her groove back, and we saw little of it. And it's all a bit imbalanced given that they could have cut some of Caitlin's reunion with her father to better further the other subplots. So I feel like I'm repeating myself, but the writer should have just pulled the trigger on Caitlin becoming Killer Frost full-time instead of giving us the 50-second version of this half-baked, nonsensical storyline that has very little forward movement and has made no real impact. Finally, I think it's just really sad that the only reason you can get Barry to care about the storyline, because it kind of his whole thing in this episode was kind of forced, that you had to have him think about it from his own perspective as a dad to Nora. I don't know what to say.
What's the 10 minutes I missed? I don't even know how Barry even got into the storyline.
That's the thing. Yeah, that's the thing. It was the most forced introduction ever. Like, We didn't even see Barry find out about the situation. It was literally Barry and Cisco send off the rest of the team in order to do, like, business same things, like, to do the parts of the storyline that are actually going to forward the plot. Barry and Cisco, send off the rest of the team to do Cicada-related business plot things. And then Caitlin is like, I bet it's not a coincidence that we're the only three left here. And Barry's like, yeah, I guess we're going to find your dad. And then Cisco's like, yep, we are all caught up. We know what's going on. And now we're going to go get your dad. And I was like, this is like, that about sums up the episode for me. Like, that's just like the level of writing that this whole episode was. And Danielle really does need a new acting coach. I think that's what it is. I'm going to blame her acting coach because she says she's had the same one her whole life. She has not improved. It's time. Let him or her go. Because they're not working for you, babe. I did not like Caitlin yelling at Cisco and then acquiescing to Barry minutes later. Like, Barry comes in and was like, hey, Cisco might have a point. You know what, Barry? You might be right. And then she apologized to both of them, even though only Cisco needed an apology. So I was, whatever. It just felt like, not a reversal, but they were written so well in the fifth episode and all dolled up. And, like, that's what I want to see from Killer Vibe. And this episode was back to just, Caitlin sort of just, like, using Cisco as a dish rag. And when he pulled it up, like, he brought up that, like, people just, like, use him, like, expect him to do everything. And I was like, yes! But that didn't go anywhere, right? Because Cisco isn't allowed to actually hold grudges or, except for that one time in season three and everyone hated him for it, so, anyway, that was super white. I didn't like it. There was also no emotional impact to Thomas and Caitlin because we have never seen Thomas before. We don't know Thomas from Adam. And we've only heard about him for, like, 3 episodes total. So wasting 20 minutes of screen time and not even bringing in Caitlin's mom, who is, like, a central, like, the centrifugal force of this storyline. Like, she obviously helped hide Thomas Wayne. She was obviously trying to protect Caitlin from that alter ego. Like, does she even know that Caitlin has Killer Frost? Like, we don't know anything. And Caitlin is like, I've resolved my lifelong grudge against my mother off screen because my mother's not here. But so glad she's protecting me. Like, the 1 ounce of interest that I could have had in that storyline. And, like, I'm speaking for, like, probably any audience member who already does not have a vested interest as Caitlin. Because, like, yeah, sure, if you're interested in her, you're going to find something interesting. But, like, as the person who's just blasé, like, the one emotional that I could have had, you took it from me because you didn't put her mom in there. So now it's just some dude named Thomas and Caitlin. And then being like, oh! And they weren't even, the reunion wasn't even that emotional. It wasn't even that emotional because, you know, reasons that have already been stated. So, when Cisco is the most emotional part of your storyline and he has literally nothing to do with it, then you have a problem. So, yeah. I don't even think there isn't even enough of the rest of the storylines to have something to dislike about them. Yeah. They were all fine for the 2 minutes of screen time they got. Mm-hmm. So, that's that on that.
And I feel like that's what pisses me off the most is, like, there are 3 subplots in this episode. Like, 3. And yet having 4 plot lines didn't shorten the A-plot at all. Like, you would think that if they wanted to squeeze that many storylines in 1 episode, they would shorten the A-plot a little bit and allocate more screen time to, like, the secondary plots to give them room to breathe. But instead we get 3 subplots, all of which are more interesting than the A-plot, sharing the same B-plot screen time. And so everything is, like, squeezed tightly while the A-plot drags out because they have to fill out all of the screen time. And so it just goes slow and it goes nowhere. So as, like, a result, there wasn't enough interesting things to balance out the Killer Frost plot and make the episode more bearable. Because the Killer Frost plot had so many holes. Like, I literally tweeted, thank God, when Team Irish Sherlock and Laura returned to Star Labs to signal the end of this Caitlin Stop story. Like, when she came out of that aircon, I was like, thank you, mother has returned.
Yes, I felt the same.
And, like Tati does this thing where she calculates all the screen time that women get each episode. And Iris got 6 minutes this episode. 6. Like, everyone got paid in gusts in these BCD plots this week. But, like, the more aggravating thing to me is that this is a pattern specifically with Caitlin heavy episodes and Iris getting the shafts story-wise. So, like, in Caitlin heavy episodes, Iris' screen time is always limited. There's a lot of Caitlin's story, and Iris is kind of paid dust. But they never keep that same energy when the episode is Iris heavy. When Iris is the center of the episode and Caitlin's in the subplot, Caitlin still gets a decent story within that episode. But it doesn't happen in the other way around, which I find aggravating. And even when they should give more screen time to Iris' story, not because, you know, hashtag anti-feminism, but, like, for reasons where they should, you know, back up. Like, Caitlin gets this much screen time, even when they should limit it, her story, not for, like, anti-feminism reasons, but for actual story reasons that her story could be compressed and you still get the same result. So, like, for example, in last week, it was Iris West Allen-centric heavy episode, but they only had 1 B-plot. So this week, Caitlin's story has, you know, everybody else's spread out among 3 plots, whereas last week Iris' story only had 1 B-plot, and that B-plot was Caitlin. And so rather than spending a whole 10-ish minutes watching Caitlin spin her wheels in episode 5, and then doing the whole story again in episode 6, I feel like at least one of these C or D plots, preferably Cicadas, could have gotten more focus in episode 5. So, like, cut Caitlin's story in half and give Cicadas some room in episode 5, and you still feel like the story was, like, pushing forward, and you wouldn't feel like such an afterthought in episode 6. Other things, I mean, I could go back and count the number of ice cold puns in this episode, but that would mean actually having to watch the episode again. And seeing as how I didn't even go back to watch 10 minutes I missed, that's probably not going to happen. But I do remember that there were a lot and they were clunky and, you know, it was like, you know, okay, we get it. The whole plot was clunky, anticlimactic moments, predictable. When all of your characters, not named Cisco, have to be stupid for your plot to work, maybe it's not a good plot. You spent 5 episodes trying to find this man, and then suddenly they find him immediately, thanks to, like, the magic fucking satellites that suddenly work, and you can suddenly pinpoint him exactly where he you have 20 years worth of basic rations stored up, you know? And then you got Star Labs feed from Wells. First of all, why? Second of all, how? Like, he had supposedly been dead for 10 years already, so how did Wells find him to give him Star Labs feeds to look at? And obviously, if he got them from A. Wells, it was probably Eobard, so why didn't that raise a flag to anybody? In addition to not locking their doors, like, this is just what, you know, if he's been watching them for years, it just makes me feel like, in addition to not locking their doors, they also haven't upgraded, like, or updated the security cameras in Star Labs. They haven't done general security sweep to make sure they weren't being bugged. Like, you know, great job, guys, you know? So I thought it was, like, a cop-out or, you know, weird conventional plot device that, you know, he was watching them for years just because, and only couldn't reach out until recently. That's just stupid. I didn't like Caitlin yelling to Sisko when he was trying to help her, only to suddenly be convinced, like, 2 seconds later. And it wasn't even exactly Barry that convinced her. Like, her line of reasoning went, Barry saying, like, your dad's a liar, and Caitlin's like, fuck you, Barry. Wait, fuck. F-U-C-K. K is a oh shit, you're right, my dad is evil. Like, that's how my sister, like, her reasoning was. Like, did you not know when you were making the serum that all this stuff was happening? So, like, what was, you didn't even see, like, the revelation point where she starts to think about, you know, thinking about this like a scientist kind of thing. So it's just kind of, again, it's clunky. I feel like Tom confessing to actually being the alter ego and debilitating Barry, Sisko, and Caitlin with his ice breath was painful. Like, that scene was painful. And not, like, emotionally painful, like, oh my god, this is so sad, but, like, the actual act of Danielle falling on the ground was painful. Like, she had to, like, stretch that scene out, but for at least, like, 3 seconds, I'm pretty sure. Like, you calculated how long that scene was supposed to be versus how long it took her to fall out. Like, she definitely milked that. Like, you know that one character that just has to, like, die as dramatically as possible? That was Danielle falling to the ground. Like, it was,
like,
the
workers in the Midsummer Night's Dream where they're putting on the play, and he's like, oh, now I die. I'm dying. I'm still dead.
They, like, magically wake up like you think they're dead, and they, like, magically revive just to, like, die again. yeah, like, all of her friends, another thing, like, these things, like, Caitlin has to be dumbed down for them to work. Like, when all her friends are freezing to death around her when they go to confront Thomas, and it takes Iris and Sherlock telling her, you're fine, for her to realize that she is fine and that she's not dying because she's not cold. And, like, you know, why did you need them to point that out for you to make that obvious conclusion for yourself? And then speaking of that battle, like, I don't get the point of having every single meta on your meta team run blindly into danger at the exact same time. So, like, maybe if one or two of them had stayed back, they would have all been nerfed, like, immediately upon, like, confronting Thomas. And then you also wouldn't have Iris and Sherlock stuck in Star Labs, stating the obvious, but not being able to offer any helpful strategies because all the heroes are knocked out. So it just seems stupid to have them look like, you're going to die, guys. It's getting close. You're dying. And, like, no one on the hero team can do anything about it. And, like, you know, the whole like, all along, like, no strap. Like, we knew this already. So, like you guys said, like, that emotional, there was no emotional kind of reunion because it's just, like, duh. And then this is, like, my final nitpick of this episode. Whatever Chris Klein is doing with his voice, he needs to stop it. Because it's weird. And he's just, like, I don't like it. So that's it. That's my entire rant. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
That seems like the whole episode, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also realized that, like, all of a sudden she's ready to find her dad because Sisko fired up the satellites, but we never really saw her work through any of her emotions. Like, they could have used her mom that way, like, to talk to her about how, you know, she was feeling. She found out her dad was alive, but they didn't. So it was all just stupid.
Yeah. Predictions?
No.
Synchronization, no. Nothing from this episode.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm too, like, prediction for the Flash. There are no fucks left for me to give. I have zero fucks, fuck deficient, negative fucks. Anyway, moving on to Black Lightning. So, in Black Lightning, you're dealing with guilt. Black Lightning and Thunder, this synopsis was written very weirdly because I don't think that the person that wrote the synopsis actually watched the episode. But they said that Black Lightning and Thunder return to South Greenland in an attempt to figure out what is going on. Well, that's not exactly true. With the return to South Greenland to find Anissa. Anissa went to find Anissa. She went to find herself. No, just kidding. Anissa went to find Anaya, and she comes across she comes into this whole kind of like Romeo and Juliet race war situation going on in South Greenland, where all of the white people are bonded or enslaved to this new meta named the Looker, who gives them the silver element that gives them all these superpowers. And they are in a war with the black people of South Greenland, who all live in the woods, wooded communities, off the grid, heavily armed. None of them like each other. And so the fact that White Deacon and Black Anaya fell in love and they're having babies is sparking a kind of war between the two. So not only does Anissa have to save Anaya, she also has to kind of navigate this race tension going on. Meanwhile, between the Sanjay for the white people and the Purdy for the black people. Meanwhile, back in North Freeland, I guess, Lynn is still feeling a tremendous amount of guilt over the death of the 14 green light babies, and she falls into a deep depression, which Jennifer is not very helpful. And then lastly, Tobias is still abusing Khalil, and he's also having a kind of a temper tantrum because things aren't going his way. The money he threw at the Reverend Holt to buy the clinic and move it is being rejected because Holt is not full. He was born that night, not last night. And so now Tobias' plan is falling apart. And surprise, Gandhi is alive. This episode was directed by Oz Scott and written by Pat Charles. What did you like?
Tati?
Am I going first or are you going first, May?
You can go first.
All right. I liked Gambi shooting the man and trying to kill him in front of his family, aka his dogs. That was hilarious. And then he was like, I'm sorry, girl. Sorry you had to see that. And Reverend Holt, beautiful, God-fearing badass. I love him. When he was like, kiss my holy ass. Praise Jesus.
That was
what
great.
A great man. And speaking of, I love that Khalil wants to break free. He refuses to kill the Reverend. I felt bad for him when he was realizing that Tobias is the root of all his problems. And then he tried to beat Tobias' ass, even though he failed and got his own ass beat. And then, you know, twice he went to Jennifer for comfort and advice, and he just really owned my ass this episode. Yeah, when Jennifer was teasing about his bad decisions, and he was like, oh, but I've made some good ones, too. Meaningful glance, and she didn't understand what he was saying. My heart hurts! So, yes. Also owning my ass was Anissa this week. I loved her going out on a limb for Anaya, like she like bridged the gap between her and her family, helped birth frickin' twins, protected her from Looker's gang, just like, and everything was going on was awesome. She did a really good job as a doctor, as a person, as a human being, as a superhero. You go, girl. Lynn, very heartbreaking. I felt really bad for her. Like, her grief was really palpable. Kristen did an amazing job. And, of course, it was, like, compounded by the public nature of that situation, of, like, her mistake, if you will, and how she had to deal with all these angry parents in mourning, and she didn't have a path to do what was, I don't know, most effective or, like, the most helpful thing, right? And, of course, she's wallowing in her own guilt, too, so it's hard for her to get out of that. And I love Jennifer trying to help her, trying to be there for her. That was really sweet. I loved that there was a Markovia mention.
Damn.
In one of the Gabby scenes. I was like, Young Justice Outsiders? Here we come! So, yes, that's all.
That was really cool. That was a nice Easter egg.
I agree with all of this. Anissa taking a risk and going back to South Freeland to talk to Anaya was nothing less than what I expect from her. She's so passionate about helping people, and I really admire that about her. Like, she not only helped Anaya give birth, but basically fell into the middle of a lot of family drama and problems and town drama, and she had to deal with all of that, too, and, like, she handled it really well. Like, she had patience, and even though it was tested a couple of times, she persevered and worked to get the family to safety regardless of their personal feelings about Anaya and Deacon. And I really felt bad for Khalil this week. He inadvertently discovered that Tobias was behind his paralysis, and you could really sense how conflicted he was. And I like that he feels Jennifer is the only good decision that he made and that he has her to talk to through this time. And they're really making it hard to not want them to get back together somehow, especially with Khalil's growth this season and further mistreatment from Tobias. And I want to be stubborn, but they're writing his redemption really well, and I'm really close to shipping them again. Lynn broke my heart too this week. I'm glad the show allowed her some time to openly grieve about the loss of the 14 Greenlight kids while also facing the parents' grief over their deaths too. And I don't think Jennifer's talk really helped, but I'm glad that she was still there for her mom, even if she just gave her the space to be alone with her feelings after her initial, you know, talk. Like, in the end, Jennifer's presence was enough, even though her words weren't. And finally, I like that Jefferson went straight to help Anissa after finding out that she was in South Freeland and that they were still a bit, like, they were at each other's throats a little bit, even while they were fighting. But that he just, like, ran to help her. That was really nice.
Yeah. I like that Jennifer, like, she was super blind. Like, she was not wrong.
Yeah.
She was super blind. And I feel like once Lynn is able to get out of the funk that she's in, she'll be able to see kind of what Jennifer is actually saying. But I do like that Jennifer actually wanted to check in her mom and to just kind of, like, be there, with her, non-verbally, since verbally was not working and Lynn wasn't ready to hear it. And I also, like, I really like that Anissa went back to South Freeland, but this time she turned on a tracker so that, and it turned out Gandy, because he's still alive, knew where she was, and also Jefferson would, she figured that he would eventually go down to Gandy's tailor shop to find her and realize where she was. She had a plan to get her dad to her, which I thought was really smart of her. I liked her speaking up on Anaya's behalf and really just being there for Anaya. Even not only is she kind of fighting back against Sanjay, who are after Anaya, but she also has to protect Anaya from Anaya's family, who are also, you know, not happy. I like that Anaya's father was deaf. And I think that it was just kind of an interesting kind of surprise to when she was introduced to the parents and he was deaf, because when you think of diversity on TV, you usually have, like, the race, gender, ethnicity covered and talked about, but oftentimes, like, other types of diversity, like deafness, like blindness, other things are often, like, missed or kind of overlooked or not really thought about when you first think about how to make TV more inclusive and more diverse. So I like that her father was deaf and that was just treated as kind of like a normal thing. Like, there didn't have to be, like, a story around it. It was just kind of included as, like, a, you know, there wasn't, like, a beat skipped because Anissa had to realize that her dad was deaf, you know, or whatever. Right. I like that a lot. I thought the Romeo-Juliet race war thing was interesting. Like, it was a lot. Like, Looker is kind of like a True Blood failed character concept. It was very True Blood to me with her, because they were all kind of like,
yeah, like, she looked like she belonged in True Blood for sure.
Right. And then you have, like, all the white people with, like, the super speeders, like, this seems a little like vampires or whatever. But it was really interesting. It was just a lot when you put that with the whole racial tension and them not liking each other. That was kind of, it was a lot to take in. But it was interesting. Back on the other side of town, Lynn's storyline, I feel like, was super heavy, but I like that they gave her the space to work through her feelings. So I felt like that was giving Lynn a lot of respect to, like, let her go through that, like, this thing happened, and it wasn't, like, glossed over. And Lynn having to deal with, like, the fallout of that, and seeing, like, how depressed she was about losing these kids, because she was very much invested in trying to save all of them, and she's so full of love. So watching her go through that, I like they give her the space to do that, because if it was, for example, like Iris in season 2, you would just have, like, one scene of, like, Lynn crying with a drink in a corner, and then we wouldn't talk about it again. So I like that. I liked that Khalil finally knows that Tobias is behind his pain, because I feel like that's just one more step almost half-hearted attempt to, like, run out of Freeland or else, and that he was, the whole Disney line, like, all I gotta do is stay black and die. That was one of my favorites. He was just full of, like, good lines this episode, and how he was still trying to, you know, talk back to Khalil and try and get Khalil to see that he's going down the wrong path. Like, Khalil is supposedly trying to scare the Reverend, but instead, like, Khalil's, like, one smart mouth comment away from getting an ass whooping for being disrespectful, basically. Like, the Reverend was not scared of Khalil. I do like that he tried to, you know, say, like, it's never too late, not for Jesus. Like, it was a very Black Reverend thing to do, really say. And, you know, him just trying to be a true Reverend through to the end. You know, save Khalil, let the church say amen. Hallelujah, thank you, Jesus. Love that. Things that we did not like about this episode.
Gummo. It's that time again. Mm-hmm. All right. Things I did not like. Okay. I just don't like Looker. I don't know. Like you said, she feels like she came from True Blood. I don't, like, she's only, I have so many questions about her, but, like, I don't even want them answered, but I have them. So I'm just like, so she's been in South Freeland for 5 years. She just came 5 years ago. So did she break that? No, they said she was there for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
Except the gun running business has been with her for 30 years, and the opiates. So she saved them from that, quote unquote. So that means she brought in whatever weird power she has. So that's coming from somewhere else. And also, like, why does she personally care so much about maintaining the segregation? And also, because she just came and went, oh, this is a racist town. I found my people. And then, like, how is the rest, like, no one else has ever heard of this town or, like, heard about what's going on there? Like, it's like, oh, what? There's a place below us that has people segregated? And we didn't know about it? So I was just like, okay, this is weird. Everything about this is weird. And I just, again, like, you will stay. Like, Jessica will say, it's proof that they don't know what's going on with Tobias. Like, they don't know what to do with Tobias. They're like, let's bring in another major villain, when we have not at all resolved the current one. So, alright. And I thought he had so much potential last season. And this season, it just feels like he's just, like, it's like he has more screen time than he did last season, when he would just disappear for episodes at a time, when we really wanted to see him. And now he's there, and I'm like, why? What are you contributing right now? Nothing. And then also, just, Gambi being alive. Like, I'm happy he's alive, because I like Gambi, but I'm not happy that we spent a whole episode on, like, the grief. Jefferson's, like, you know, five stages of grief. And then Gambi's like, hello, I am alive. And there's, like, no correlation right now. Like, we don't know, you know, no reaching out to Jefferson. He's just like, I gotta shoot some people first, and, like, stare at some footage.
He sends, like, a drone to pull their fight, and no one notices this drone, like, flying around. Like, doesn't, you know, between Anissa and Jefferson, they don't realize, like, what the fuck is this drone doing here? Who could be controlling it?
I mean, he's just gonna be, like, their little guardian angel for a while or something? I don't know. Guardian demon? Because he's not that angelic, but I don't know. Very weird. So that was, like, yeah. So, like, I don't have very many, like, specific dislikes, but I just feel like I had, like, a general sense of just, like, wait, what? Like, literally, the opening scene with Looker, probably because it said Legacies in the corner, I thought that I had done something wrong, and I was now suddenly watching an episode of Legacies. And I was like, what is going on? And it took, like, a whole scene for me to finally realize that it was actually Black Lightning, and that was what we thought was alien goo is actually Looker's, like, body, and the people are one with her or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah, it certainly did take us out of, like, the main plot, because it just felt like some random episode. But, I agree with everything you said. Like, Gambi being alive and not bothering to tell Jefferson or any of the other Pierce family members that he was alive. How long does he intend to be sitting out like this while they mourn him? Like, the least he could do is just send them some sort of sign. Like, I'm okay, but I'm gonna be behind the scenes for a while.
Yeah, exactly. So you're like, don't light up.
Yeah. I'll be back. Send them, like, a drone DM. I don't know. The whole South Freeland stuff took me out a bit because it felt like a new introduction to a whole new subplot, all while there's still so much going on with the main plot that hasn't really moved forward. And I did think it was weird that South Freeland has been so secluded, like you said, from North Freeland, that, like, no one knew what was going on there. Like, how big is North Freeland, and why did it split up? And finally, like, I didn't like that Tobias is just sitting around doing next to nothing. His plot is at a standstill, So nothing he was doing last season has really come into play this season, which is concerning, seeing as how we're six episodes into the season and there's like been no, there's been no movement.
Yeah. And I thought it was, the whole South Greenland plot was interesting, but like I also said, I feel like it was a lot, especially with like the segregation and the racial tension, and then like Looker being just racist in general. Like, she didn't even want to touch the black baby. She was like obviously, like, literally disgusted that this black baby had her powers, and I was just like, you know, I'm not a fan of her at all. And like, I feel like with, like you guys said, with the introduction of this new like Scooby-Doo type mystery with Looker in South Greenland, it feels like another world. And it just makes me more convinced that they just don't know what the fuck to do with Tobias. That they introduce this whole other plot and saga with Looker. He's had like the same, let's physically and verbally abuse Khalil storyline for explicitly for three episodes. They finally had a blow up fight, which thank God, yay Khalil. But next week it's just gonna be back to business because Khalil loses the fight and gets beat down. So what was the point? Not gift. Like, save Khalil or, you know, do something. And like Tobias is, you know, this whole episode was just Tobias having like a tantrum because he's playing like a game of Monopoly by himself for the hell of it, and we don't know what he's doing with the land he's buying. Like, I feel like it can be a secret from the other characters, it's fine. They don't have to know his business, but why is it a secret from the audience? Like, why can't we know what his plan is with this? I guess, like, he talked to his pseudo-father before he killed him about him wanting to, like, run guns or whatever, but it just feels very basic. Like, I don't even know where is the 100? Like, where is his game? Hell, where's Lala? Like, where, like, that little piece of mysticism that we had in season one is just out the window now, I guess, because Lala didn't die again. That I know of, but like that's where it was just dropped. And so it's just kind of this weird thing. And I feel like, you know, doesn't Jefferson have like a whole school to worry about? Because there's a whole mess of everything that's been dropped for now. Like, wasn't he trying to find Tobias that's been dropped for now? So I'm not really sure where the direction is. Like, I feel like it's one thing you say is good is like, on this whole, and within the overall arching plot, you have like mini sagas, and I feel like the Looker saga is a mini saga, so you could look at it that way. But the main plot or plots with the school and Tobias aren't really moving forward at all, nothing's happening with them, so it just feels kind of a little bit disjointed, and like his Jefferson's attention is being split in all these different ways. Technically, the way the episode was cut, I thought was really weird. Specifically, there are some weird cuts and transitions from Anissa to Lynn to Jefferson, I think, when Anissa's, like, delivering the babies, and you cut to Lynn's depression, and you cut to Jefferson looking for Anissa, and, like, none of the plots kind of matched or coordinated really well in those scenes, so I don't really know why they chose to cut the scenes like that, so I thought that was kind of odd. You've got, in Lynn's plot, the father rear-ending Lynn's car to badger her about his daughter. I thought that was a bit much, because she'd get, like, the full brunt of it at the parent conference, and then this man, like, waits to stalk her to hit her car to force her to talk to him. So I thought it was a little bit much on his part. But then again, like, why couldn't Lynn just tell the man yes or no? Like, that's all he wanted to know, is his daughter alive or not? And it's not like she didn't know. You know, there's no way that she couldn't have known which kids died. There's only 28 of them, and as much as she wants to protect all these kids, you can't tell me that she didn't know who their names were and exactly which ones died. So if he's doing all this, if he's willing to rear-end you to find out if this child is alive, just, like, tell him, perhaps, you know? It's, you know, not that much of a legal, you know, whatever to say, yes, your child died, or no, your child didn't die. So I don't really know why she was, you know, kept running away from that. Predictions?
I currently have none.
I always predictions for each episode. She's like, no.
It's not the week to predict, okay? My fortune teller told me not to tell fortunes this week. I gotta wait till next week.
I will say, Outsiders. And then you have Dr. James, who is a villain from the Outsiders. And then you have the stuff going on with Grace, and then introducing her powers. So I feel like they are, I don't know if they're like trying to, part of the world building is setting up for an Outsiders spinoff, or maybe an Outsiders saga. But I do think that they're also not really doing a lot of Thunder Grace because they're waiting for the Outsiders to actually care about it. So
I hope so.
Yeah.
I like that. That makes me happy to see the Outsiders.
That's yeah. So I feel like they're doing a lot of build up for that, probably. Finally, we move over into Titans. This summary, when the Messenger, which is apparently Dr. Adamson, reveals that Rachel's birth mother is alive, being held captive by the organization in a serious psychiatric facility, Rachel is determined to rescue her with or without her new parents, Dick and Corey. But once inside, the Titans, and mainly just Dick, Corey, and Gar, are faced with their deepest vulnerabilities and fears. And Rachel does find her mother. So, what did we think about this episode? What did we like?
Well, I loved Rachel and Gar's little rebellious team-up. I love when he said, if you agree with people, they tend to leave you alone. Like, that's what he'd learned. Because I think that revealed a lot about his life, you know, thus far, his personality in general, what it was like, you know, what it's probably like for the Doom Patrol living with Chief. So, yeah, please protect my son. I love him. He is innocent. Also, I love that he used Corey's Uber app to get the ride to the asylum. That's great. You know, gotta make the best of what you got. And also, the look of horror on his face when he realized that he would beat the shit out of that guard was, you know, really heartbreaking. Because I was like, oh, you are the only one who was nonviolent! Now we're all in the same boat. So, yeah, I fell for him. And as for Rachel, I really loved how she used to reach out to people. Like, you know, we don't get to see her use her empath powers a lot, but we see it in how she behaves, right? She wants to save even the worst of the worst at first. Like, her first instinct was to save slash heal that messenger guy, Dr. Adamson, instead of just letting him bleed out. But when you threaten her loved ones, it's the opposite, right? And then her dark side comes out, and she rips that healing touch right back out of you, and then you fucking die. I also love her affinity, you know, to Dick. I think that's really moving. It's like, I love that little father-daughter dynamic they got going on, and it was the start of the show, so I'm glad it continues to carry through. I liked Dick's drugged-up dream sequence. It's like, say that three times fast. Which I think was in the Batcave. Maybe if there was more light, I could tell. But I like Baby Robin wailing on him, you know, blaming him for the monsters that they became, which felt really true to his character, and it was nice to be afforded another glimpse into his broken psyche. And I liked how the episode ended, you know, burning his suit. Like, that felt like a fresh start. It felt very symbolic. Speaking of symbolism, Corey being the one that ignites the spark that sets the asylum aflame, I thought was also very nice and symbolic. Like, she saved Rachel from the organization doing this. She rescues Dick from his past, metaphorically speaking. She's also, like, the sun, you know, she gets her power from the sun. She's, like, the light, okay? Yeah, you understand. It's great. I like it. That's it.
Yeah, Nightwing, here we come.
Yay!
I think this was, like, a strong episode in that it got in the head of at least some of the characters, and at least Rachel got to find her mom and find out that her dad was alive. I don't know if that she knew that, per se. So, like, this was the best aspect of the usage of Dick's story so far. Like, the way that they put it into the episode. And seeing him battle his own inner demons while he was drugged up was good. And, like, to see the disappointment of his younger self was really well done. Gar killing for the first time was depressing, but it was really well done. And my heart broke watching him sit in the cage for a few minutes, kind of, like, taking it in and realizing what he'd done and how traumatized he looked. Corey blowing up the asylum and walking out with the fire blazing behind her was totally badass. And we only learned that she can heal quickly this episode, but I'm glad she got to take out the place that caused her friend so much pain. And finally, Rachel getting to reunite with her mom was sad and sweet. And then her taking back the death of Anderson. I keep calling him Anderson. It is
Adamson.
Was really good because it showed both sides of her and her powers, like Tati said. The good and the bad.
Yeah. And I liked, in the beginning, like, after they have, like, the whole talk about, you know, your mother is still alive, and you see the kind of the family dynamic split with, you know, I like that Rachel, when she got a no from dad, she went to mom, and then, you know, when mom said no as well, like, she and Gar just, like, rebelled against parents and, like, went on their own, to agree with Dick and Corey, and then going back and like when he totally had no intention of doing what they said and was going to be there for Rachel and do what she wanted to do to find her mom. I thought it was really it showed the bond between Gar and Rachel, which I thought was really good. And then you get really sad when he says that, you know, it's just best to agree with people and they leave you alone, because it does remind of like his life with the chief, and that made me sad. But then they stole Corey's Uber account, and I was like, hey, okay. And I do like them kind of like, you know, going back and forth in the car, talking about like what it's going to be like when Rachel like finally gets to meet her mom, and her being kind of nervous, and Gar offering support in the way that he could, like relating it to animals, and you know, the mother always knowing her child by the smell. I think Rachel's like, are you telling me that I'm smelly? And he's like, So I like seeing them kind of bond in their shared rebellion. And then back on the opposite side, Dick and Corey, you know, strategizing on the best way to enter the building. I like how, like, Corey even initially says, like, you know how I'd hate to agree with him. Like, they're kind of dynamic, and now she's like, you know, I really don't like to agree with Dick, but he is actually kind of right. Just, like, another side to their dynamic and watching them, like, work together to rescue Gar and Rachel from the organization. I like Dick's... It sounds weird to say I like Dick's suffering.
I thought you were just gonna stop and like, I like Dick, but I was like, okay, I guess.
But I like that in his mind, like, his inner demon was his younger self, and his younger self was actually, like, dropping knowledge and telling him, like, you know, you keep blaming Zuko, you keep blaming Bruce, but it's you, you're the person that was making the decisions, it's your fault, kind of thing. And not that, you know, because I've been saying it for, like, weeks, like, he's been putting all this blame on Bruce for the way that he is, when, you know, some of that is Dick making his own decisions. So it was good to see that his inner self agreed, and then maybe he'll come out of that with like a different perspective. And then like at the going chronologically, I like that Rachel actually unsaved Dr. Atkinson and let him die. It was time for him to die, and that she went and saved all of her friends. The babies got their first kills this episode, so Rachel with Dr. Adamson, and then Gar with the guard. Like you guys said, it was really sad to see Gar kind of realize what he had done, because he just kind of, like, blacked out into a rage. So it was a really significant moment for both of them, for Gar and then for Rachel, when she, like, blacked out and unsaved him and kind of, like, realized the weight of what she had done as well. And then her meeting her mother, and her mother actually not like rejecting her, because I was really afraid that she was so excited to meet her mom and then it wouldn't be the reunion that she thought it was going to be. But I like that that was there. And then Rachel bringing Dick back, and then, you know, Corey setting the building on fire was great. And her, well, actually back up, Dick's asking Corey if she was okay when they all saved her. I thought that was a good scene. And then at the end, her offering comfort to Dick while he watched, like, his suit burn. And it was, like you guys said, it was a really symbolic moment of, like, he literally cannot be Robin anymore because his suit is gone. And I thought that was a nice symbolic gesture. Things that we did not like about this episode.
I don't know what the point of it was, narratively speaking. Because I still don't know who the organization are, like, what they want, what they do. I don't know anything about Rachel's mother, Angela. Like, she's alive, but, and they were like, that's your mom. And she's like, you're my mom. That's the fat on that. I couldn't see shit, because it was so dark. Why we spent a whole episode rehashing Dick's emotional stars, while we have to imagine that Corey and Gar have them, and we don't get to see anything for them. Like, why couldn't they all three have had the same drug injection, but we could see all of their fears and all of their insecurities in one episode? So then it would be like, this is the episode where we learn what everyone is feeling about things. But instead it was like, this is the episode where we learn what Dick is feeling about things. And we always know what Rachel's feeling, because she's an empath. And Corey exists, and Gar has two lines that you could read into that exist. Anyway, also, it was just so easy to rescue everybody that I was just like, this is so anticlimactic. Like, come on, guys, we're going home. And then there was the fight scene. And then the fire at the end. There you go.
Yeah, I completely agree about them, that they should have drugged everybody else. Like, I was looking forward to seeing more of Corey's development as a person and seeing more of her powers come out just because of them being at the asylum. But instead, the only thing we got was her being tied to a table and experimented on, but didn't further her story. So the same thing happened with Gar. We didn't see anything of his backstory. It's like, is this the 7th episode?
Yeah.
And there's like 11 of them only, so I don't feel there's any tension being built towards the finale, and more like the show is just biding its time until the final showdown. And Tati's like correct that we learned nothing new about the organization, so while the episode had some strong moments, it did feel like filler rather than a bigger step towards the finale.
Yeah. It is. Because Corey still has this whole mystery of her own that she doesn't even know who the fuck she is or where she's coming from. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if maybe they're just going to shelf that mystery until maybe like season 2 will be more Gar Corey heavy, because it's definitely very racial dick heavy in season 1. I didn't like that Adams and Guy like slit his throat in front of Rachel. Like, why would you do that to her? You know, that's, I didn't like that at all. I don't like him, so I'm glad he's gone. Just like, I think my biggest gripe is that it was just so fucking dark, and not like thematically, but like literally anything. Like, why can't some cycles that happen during the day, like, even if you're in like an asylum, there's still light in there, you can still hear, like, people still be working. So I like, you know, I don't like not being able to see shit. Yeah, like, you know, I guess I don't even know what else to say about it. Like, I guess my biggest gripe, and it was a little bit disturbing, like, having all of them being tortured. And, you know, while I liked Rachel and Gar rebelling, it was just, like, the dumbest thing that they could have done to, like, run blindly based off of the word of a man that's trying to kidnap Rachel. I thought it was dumb that she took that and just went. Like, Dick was not saying that we're not going to save your mother ever. He's like, we need a plan, but, you know, she didn't wait for the plan, and then they get kidnapped and all of her friends get tortured. While she's chilling in a lounge waiting for tea. But, yes, I didn't like watching them all get tortured for most of the episode when the only one that we actually find out stuff about is Dick. You do find out that Corey has some regenerative powers, but, like, watching people strap her to a table and cut her open while she's awake and waiting for her awake to be awake for them to do that to her, I didn't need to see that. I didn't need to see, you know, Gar get emotionally abused in a cage until he snaps and finally kills somebody. Because we don't really, you know, I guess the point of it was pushing him towards his first kill, and the point of Corey's was learning that she has other powers, but it didn't hold the same weight as the mental breakthrough that Dick made in his fever dream, or his chemically induced dream. Yeah.
Predictions? No. I think something fishy about Angela. I actually have one there. Something fishy about Angela. She's brainwashed. She's going to do something for the organization. Like, the organization wanted them to rescue her because it was just too easy.
Oh. I definitely feel like Dr. Adamson let slip Angela. Like, Corey and Dick thought that they had got the upper hand, but I definitely think that he said that her name on purpose to get Rachel to get to the asylum.
Mm-hmm. So,
That part was like orchestrated.
I get nothing, but I'm on board with your predictions.
That.
I don't have any predictions, but I'm on board with your predictions.
Donna's coming next week, so we'll finally get to figure out how she ties into the story. So, yay, Donna Choi.
Hey, we'll learn more about Dick's backstory, because we're lacking so much of it.
Side B, Lady of Gumption nominations.
Whew! Anissa.
Yes.
Her Black Lightning. I don't have one for Flesh.
No.
You weren't that inspired by Keelan's, like, rousing performance in the Serial Killer Process? Her the most?
Nope.
Okay. I mean, for Titans, I guess I would say Rachel this week because she decided to rebel, go against Corey and Dick and decide to go save her mom. And then when everything went to hell, she tried to get everybody out of the situation too. And she, like, showed her powers, both good and bad, the bad sides of it. So I think she was, like, she was subjected to a lot, but she overcame a lot.
I think it's good that she's she was a moral center, and she saved all of her friends, but she's also the reason all of her friends were there in the first place.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I'm just giving a second nominee, but I agree that, like, Anissa would, you know, definitely take that.
Yeah, I think Anissa would win side B for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
So we have Laurel, Nora, and Anissa.
Yep. Anyone have a vote?
I guess I'm going back and forth between Laurel and Nora, just because they were both bad characters to begin with. And they're trying to turn their life around to do good, even though it's harder to do good than when they were bad. I guess I would lean towards Laurel because she had so many things and so many people working against her and not believing her.
I can definitely see that. Yeah. I would give it to Laurel. I'd be happy to give it to Laurel.
I agree with that.
Thoughts? Yes, that was an agreement.
Yeah, that was an agreement. Yes, I agree with that.
Let's go for it.
All right, so we're gonna give it to Laurel this week.
Woohoo, Laurel!
Redemption. Yes. So that is all we have for this week. Hope you guys had a happy Thanksgiving if you are living in the U.S. Next week is another week of shows, so we'll still be here.
Yay!
See you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.